Show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Hey, and good evening, and welcome aboard. You know, sometimes the universe does not cooperate with you in terms of the plans that one has made for an evening's programming. For instance, yesterday, being Monday, was Moran Monday. And we did have our fair share of Morans. But God, we got buried with them today. Holy mackerel. And you know, we did yesterday without even a passing glimmer of a nomination for the former Vice President of the United States. You know, I know that they think that, and maybe that's what this is. It's just a finger in Attorney General Eric Holder's eye. But maybe what they're doing is, well, Dick Cheney said, well, I was a proud proponent of...
Well, I was a proud proponent of waterboarding.
He said that. He admitted it in front of millions of people on the TV box on Sunday.
I was a big fan of waterboarding. We had the Office of Legal Counsel to prepare those memos to give us cover for what we were going to do.
He said it! He said it! And these are the same people who complain about the FBI Mirandizing the BVD bomber by giving him his Miranda rights. Right? You know, these right-wingers are so godforsaken stupid. Do they not realize that you can't get a conviction or use the stuff that's been said until you've Mirandized the guy? That you can't use it in court, with that not Mirandizing a fellow is enough to get his conviction overturned, and so therefore there are some technical things. Look, you know, it's just like the mass. You got it. There are some things that have to be mumbled over the cup before you can take the drink. There are some Latin words or whatever that have to be mumbled over the cracker before you can eat it. It's procedural, I guess, is the word I'm looking for. But Dick Cheney, Richard B. Dick, big time Cheney, actually admitted to war crimes. He admitted violation of the federal law. Never mind that squishy international law or those inconvenient Nuremberg promulgations. Dick Cheney admitted to a violation of a federal felony that carries the death penalty. And what he's betting on is that nobody in the Obama administration has the guts to call him out.
Pick up the gun. Pick up the gun. Pick up the gun.
He's betting on it. And it's a safe bet that he may be right. Oy. But that was that was pretty stupid. That was pretty moranical. So there's that. The other thing, but climate stupidity. Climate stupidity. Oh my God. This is a beautiful thing. Donald Trump. Donald Trump has declared that it's time to revoke Al Gore's Nobel Prize. Now, whatever it is that makes the multi-bankruptee flim-flam man Donald Trump think that he is qualified to comment upon issues of climate and science when the man can't even do a halfway decent comb-over. Well, you know what I mean. Agnes just walked in behind me bringing me my steaming hot cup of tea and saw the photo of Donald Trump that goes with the story I'm looking at and said, "Oh, my God, Bob." And she did it, you know, where we've been married for almost 17 years, and we can not only read each other's minds, but we read lips as well. And she said, she mouthed to me the words, "Oh, my God, he looks like flock of seagulls." Yeah, he does. The Donald was called to give him a speech. He was called to do some speechifying at the Trump National Golf Club in Westchester County, New York. You know, you have to say all of this with your teeth clenched. There were 500 members of the Trump National Golf Club in Westchester County, New York, and he said the following. With the coldest winter ever recorded, with snow setting record levels up and down the coast, the Nobel Committee should take the Nobel Prize back from Al Gore. Gore wants us to clean up our factories and plants in order to protect us from global warming when China and other countries couldn't care less. It would make us totally non-competitive in the manufacturing world. And China, Japan, and India are laughing at America's stupidity. No, Donald. We're laughing at yours. Really, we are. I hate to break your heart, but we are. That's because here we have another fool who doesn't understand that local weather does not equal global climate. And I saw the best line the other day. I forget who had it, but there is no Planet B. Everybody, okay, so much for Plan A. Let's go to Plan B. There is no Planet B. This is it. This ain't the dress rehearsal for when we get to the clean planet. I mean, after all, the NASA's budget's being rearranged, and we're going to do more robotic exploration of the... And we may finally find that Captain Kirk Class M planet with the sexy green the sexy green woman on it. We may. Or we may find one that's nice and clean and has never been just and it'll be ours to ruin. But that ain't happening day after tomorrow. Climate does not equal weather. But don't tell Donald that, because the snow is messing with his hair. Maybe it's the hair care products. Maybe that's what seeped through the skin of his scalp, down through the bone, and through the sutures of the skull, and got into his gray matter, and it turned him into an idiotic denier. Oh, and by the way, that business about making us totally non-competitive in the manufacturing world, BS. Absolute BS. Because the fact of the matter is, we hardly make anything in the first place anymore. One. And two, for instance, an American steel mill can make steel twice as clean and twice as green and twice as good as steel coming from the slave labor camps of China. Unfortunately, however, most of our metallurgical coal is being sold to China, so that if we ever do get our steel industry back up and running for making things like wind turbines, there ain't gonna be no coal to make the steel with. And of course, I think I mentioned the story where it was discussed that Don Blankenship of Massey Energy is such a swindler, such a huckster, that he is selling to the Chinese non-metallurgical grade coal for metallurgical coal because the Chinese are desperate to get their hands on it and he's desperate to unload it. And they're silly enough to buy it. What kind of steel is that going to make? Anybody, scientists out there, raise your hands. Yeah, the scientists, What kind of steel is non-metallurgical grade coal going to produce? Just asking. So yeah, we got it. We got boodles of morons. What would Reverbo say? Yeah, we got a bozo explosion. Even this evening, a carryover, a bonus, if you will, of moranity. Whew! And we will get through all of it, but we've got a call on the line, so let's not keep people waiting. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello from East Tennessee.
Well, hello, East Tennessee, Kate. What's up?
I don't have any anything to add to the political rants and stuff because I'm just not interested in that stuff anymore. You know what I mean?
You have quit. Elvis has left the building.
Yeah, speaking of Elvis, at the last RAM clinic, the remote area medical people, I did a clinic. I volunteered for a clinic in Knoxville, and there was an Elvis impersonator there with his pretty wife, Sylvia, and we talked extensively after, you know, like late in the afternoon while they were waiting their turn for dentist and vision clinics, and he invited me to come to their house and park in the, I told him I was parking in the Walmart parking lot, and he said, oh, no, you need to come on over to the house and park in the yard, and you've got a private bath, and you just come on over. You're just welcome there anytime.
He didn't say, come on over.
He did. Well, he would have, but but he'd been out on the circuit quite a bit until he had a heart attack and had to have a bunch of surgery or something. So he said he's just doing meet and greets now. So
now, which Elvis does he do? Does he do is he one of the stuffed into the skin tight white jumpsuit Elvises of the early to mid 70s, or is he one of the cooler hipper Elvises? Because if you're going to be an Elvis impersonator, you have to pick your Elvis.
Yeah, I would say, I don't know, he probably gained some weight after the heart surgery, so I would say he probably wasn't the young 20-year-old, but he wasn't the pudgy one ready to die either, so anyway. But he looked the part. Everybody knew who he was.
Hey, everybody, it ain't Elvis.
We did about 800 people, dental and vision and mammograms and pap smears and eyeglasses and extractions and fillings.
You can put all that stuff in a truck and take it places?
They've got a great big, is that clicking on the phone? Is that bothering you in your ear?
I'm not even hearing it.
Oh, Lord, it hurts my ear. It must be a dirty phone here. They bought a big, they got a $6 million donations, worth of donations after that. When was the 60 Minutes thing on? When was I in Alabama? Last year? Year before? Can't remember. But anyway, when 60 Minutes did that big piece on them, they got $6 million donations, and that was pretty outstanding. And they bought a big semi, tractor trailer with a, I don't know, 52-foot trailer, and it's pretty well rigged out, and it's got a complete vision lab in it, and they've got a smaller vision lab, and then a women's health clinic from somewhere, oh, I don't even know, they had a bunch of names on the side of the outfit, but they did mammograms and pap smears and women's health clinic in that one, and I'm not sure that, I don't know if they're directly affiliated with RAM or not, but anyway, we did a big business and going to do another one in Dandridge this weekend, the high school one. That's pretty exciting. And right now I'm in the library at Highlander and working, cataloging and filing and sorting and moving books. And the archives are wonderful. Oh, my God, this place is just wonderful.
And you get that warm, fuzzy feeling of doing decent things for people that need decent things done for them?
Well, yeah, I guess you're comparing this to Katrina relief.
I'm not really comparing to anything. I'm just talking about the general goodwill, good karma created by doing good works.
Oh, well, yeah, I'm kind of glad to not be where there's such hopelessness and despair. I mean, but I'm surrounded by it. That's what we're here for, is to do social justice and work with poverty and poverty programs and mining program, you know, coal mine and mining. And one of the education people just got back from Wise County, and she said there were about 12 people at the meeting, and they were talking about the rate of asthma in the county and how bad it was, and the how hard it was to get to the grocery store to get good food, and, you know, I mean, just pitiful, you know.
Yeah, well, then kind of,
Yeah, right, sort of. So, anyway, the I mentioned to somebody the other day that being in this library, and particularly in the archives, is like a biblioporn shop for me. My God. I just picked up.
So you're a volunteer healthcare worker by day and secret volunteer librarian by night? I mean,
every other weekend that they're having clinics. I think there's going to be one in Virginia on this first weekend in March, and then back here in the second weekend in March, and then April they're going where I don't want to go, Florida, or I don't know, someplace, but July in Oklahoma City. That sucks. I want to have my feet up in air conditioning in Arizona at that time. No, I just do whenever the clinics are, and then I work full time here at Highlander, working for the director and in the library for the librarian, depending on what, you know, what we set aside a project and do, whatever they want me to do. I haven't really gotten in touch. I mean, the director and I haven't really talked about what she needs, but it's going to be a big project, so I'm really looking forward to that. So it's pretty exciting to be here. I found a picture of a little from October 1940 in the archives. We're back there sorting and rearranging and cleaning, and there was a picture of about three or four little boys standing around a sink, regular, like, bathroom sink or something.
Right.
And they were kind of playing, you could tell the water was running, and they all had their hands in the sink and under the water. And the caption under that said that the boys came in from the mountains to, I guess something going on at Highlander, and that they were playing in the water because they didn't have running water at home in the hills. And I thought, how precious is that? Oh, my God. Kids, they've seen their first running water out of a sink, That's kind of how I felt when I went to Mrs. Smith's grocery store in Oklahoma down by Hickory Grove and saw my first loaf of white sliced white bread. I thought, what is this?
What hath God wrought?
Yeah, all right. Yeah. Oh, God. Well, yeah, I didn't have running water when I was, you know, up until we were, I don't know, I guess I was four or five. We had a pump and a cistern, but one time I drank the priming water for the pump. And
ew.
Yeah, Dad had just gone to the well down by the river to get a truckload of water and bring it home, and he dumped it in the cistern, and Mom went to, pump it into the sink, and because she'd been without water all morning, and I had drank the priming water, so we still didn't have any water. Had to go down the hill to the neighbors to get a pint of water.
Oh, brother.
Yeah, anyway. The Highlander owns the rights to We Shall Overcome, because Pete Seeger and Guy Carwin,
yeah, they do,
rearranged the song. It was, Pete changed it to We Shall Overcome from We Will. And Guy changed the tempo of it, and Guy and Candy Carwin were the ones who were the team who went out in the 30s and 40s to do all of the music work that people would, you know.
Oh, I love the fact of where you are, because all of that's all stuff that I became aware of simply by reading Jeff Bigger's book, The United States of Appalachia.
Mm-hmm.
And to hear you talking about it is just magnificent to me, Kate, because it was also alive for me in that book, and now you're down there and you're just up to your knees in it.
Yeah, on my chin. I was thinking of this the other day. I just wanted to give thanks for the support and the encouragement that I was given to get here. I've been waiting to get here since about 84, And it finally came to, with a lot of nagging and encouragement, I finally got here. So I'm just, it's really energizing. I'm just really feel blessed to be here. I found a picture of Eleanor, who she visited. I'm not sure she visited this place or the one in Knoxville. I'm sure it wasn't the one over at Montego, the one that the sheriff closed up and then it burned. But I don't know if it was which Highlander she had visited, but there's a picture of her and two gentlemen standing. She just sat in there grinning. And the librarian said, well, check with the Wisconsin archives. They've got a whole bunch of stuff. And they've got some great pictures of her. And and I found a picture of Hank Sr. sitting on a couch picking, and a little 18-month-old in bibs and with his mouth open looking up at Daddy, Junior, with a plastic guitar around his neck sitting on the couch by his daddy. Like, oh, God, what a picture.
Oh, man.
Holy
8x10, 8x10 or something, or?
No, it's on the book cover. It's on the front of a book that I can't remember the name of it. Anyway, it was a gorgeous picture. You're not old enough to remember when little boys got haircuts. We called them a burr cut. They were just, you know, you just kind of shaved the head but left a little stubble.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, well, Hank Jr. had a little burr cut in his bibs, and he was sitting there with his mouth open, gaping up at his daddy. Oh, God, it was pretty. Happy Fat Tuesday. I'm way out of
it. It is that, isn't it?
Yes, it is. This is a way different culture. Nobody knows nothing about no beads.
No king cake?
No. But that's okay. I mean, they know.
You know, on I'm magically transformed on Fat Tuesday. I'm no longer Bob Kincaid. I am Bob Kingcake.
Do you remember? Oh, speaking here. It's my call, right?
Yeah. Take all the time or the words that you need, Kate.
Just take a deep breath and figure it out. Do you remember me telling you last year when I was doing the Presbyterians and that we had dumb...
You know, that don't work like that.
What?
Don't say when I... They're your words and everything, but don't say when I was doing the Presbyterians. The Presbyterians don't take kindly to it.
The Presbyterian thing.
Okay.
The volunteering with the blue shirt.
Yes, right, okay. We got a lot of dirty minds out in the audience. I don't want you helping them.
That would not be a dirty remark. That would be a salacious one, but not dirty.
Well, okay.
It's like we're not at war in Afghanistan. Either.
Hair splitter.
I keep nagging at you about, that's not the right word, Bob.
Yeah, but, I know. Hey, let's do that for a minute.
Okay. Get back to the king cake in a minute. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah,
what?
That war versus, you know, that's like insisting, and I'm not picking, but that's like saying, that you have to say the Vietnam police action.
Yeah.
Because that was what it was termed by us. And you know, I guess I tend to look at this sort of, try to look at this thing through the eyes of the people who are having to, who are having it thrust, foisted upon them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing if you're an Afghani mama and you're carrying your little dead baby out of your mud hut like happened a couple of days ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going through your mind, I hate this occupation. I'm guessing that what's going through your mind is, I hate this war.
Probably.
It's war to them. It is a war made on them. For all the protestations of, you know, we're at war with Iraq, but not with the people of Iraq. We're at war with people in Afghanistan, but we're not at war with Afghanistan. No. When the bullet makes the bleeding and the aching and the screaming, that's war.
Okay, I'll concede that you have a point.
I think I do. Because what happened, and I think it's very important to sort of deal with this within the American mindscape, insofar as after Nuremberg, we came up with what we hoped would be a lot of nice little guidelines for nations that in the future wish to make war upon each other. And we said things, and we created phrases like crimes against humanity and war crimes and things like that. And we then proceeded And all of this in American terminology has to do with the failure of Congress to do its job. Because you're right, the Constitution clearly says that only Congress has the power to declare war. So one would think that if soldiers are somewhere shooting someone, that therefore somebody would have declared a war.
And the naive, ignorant American public think that we're at war. We're not at war. It's an illegal occupation.
But
we have just gone in and tromped on them and killed them for oil and a pipeline in Afghanistan.
And I will concede that point.
Okay.
But it is to my mind, Kate, overly legalistic. It is a definition and delineation of war versus occupation versus police action versus yada 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 that is only fathomable by the American mindset that ain't involved in it. If you ask Mama, whose baby boy is off in the dust of Afghanistan in Majra province, in Helmand province or whatever, what is your son? He's in the war in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
Mama knows.
That's because the media and the politicians keep calling it a war.
That's because it is one.
I see. Okay. Now we're starting to quibble over semantics. I guess that's what we've been doing all along, huh?
Well, no, I think it's a real and a valid point, Kate. And only, you know, only a disaffected American relying on legalisms could think that bombs falling on peasants isn't war, that we could come up with a euphemism for it like police action or illegal occupation. I like illegal occupation because it carries implicit in it the fact that what we're doing is illegal. But if you want to go that route, I would suggest you go toward crime against humanity.
Well, it's that.
Or low-level genocide.
Absolutely.
Or war. Here's one for you. The war on Islam. Because for all the fact that we say that we're not at war with Islam, it seems like the only people we're shooting are Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
That's like, you know, and I've had conversations, for instance, with folks about what I call what goes on down at Guantanamo. Because I clearly call Guantanamo a concentration camp.
Absolutely. There ain't like too many damn Catholics in there with pink skin.
Nope.
And red hair.
Nope.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Now, I just had said I'm not really don't want to go there because I'm not interested in this stuff because it just gets me. I'm just too crazy.
No, that's the thing. You are interested in it, and you're trying to stay away from it.
Let's get back to the king cake.
Yes, do.
We had king cake on Wednesday night when the lady came in, the Cajun lady came in and made food for the volunteers, and she always bring in a king cake. And I'm sitting there going, yeah, 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 and I ate my little piece of king cake, and I got the baby Jesus in it, and everybody's going, oh, you got the baby, you got the baby. And I didn't know what that meant. I just, you know, whatever. Well, you got the baby, you got baby Jesus. Look at it. And I picked it up and took it over to with my plate to the sink and said to one of the Presbyterian preacher guys, this is, why do we assume this is baby Jesus? Why couldn't it be baby Jesus' sister? Because it's not gender specific, this little doll. Oh, he just kind of blanched.
Like I said, yeah, that's, they don't take that well.
Well, you know, I don't know nothing about no Presbyterians. I don't know who they are. I just said it could be baby Jesus' sister. It's not a gender-specific doll here. It's just a little pink plastic thing. Jesus wasn't pink anyway. Oh, didn't even want to go there. But you know, I was a pain. I was a management problem for Presbyterian Disaster Relief. Today in 1916, Emma Goldman got busted big time in New York City for preaching or lecturing about birth control. They just busted her ass good. New York City. So, okay, never mind. We are having, speaking of politics, somebody asked me something and I said Arizona and they said, oh, Sheriff Joe, he's so cool. I rolled my eyes and thought, does this need to be said or said by me now? Yeah, hell yeah. So I went into about a 4 or 5 sentence little diatribe about Sheriff Joe and how and I didn't use the word evil, but how disruptive he is to the politics of Maricopa County and to Arizona. And I said, you know, it's dirty politics. It's probably ain't as bad as Tennessee. And the guy kind of chuckled and said, well, I can't do East Tennessee. But he said, well, it depends on which hill you're on. I thought, ooh, I wish I had more time here to explore that remark. And I said this afternoon to somebody, well, I'm gonna be leaving the hill this weekend, and then I realized, oh, well, just about 20 miles over the hill over in the other county, that's the UT, and, you know, when you're on the hill in Knoxville, you're at the university, and over here, you're in, on your Highlander, and then you go a little bit southeast or southwest or some damn place down to Pigeon Forge, I guess the hill is something else down there, you know. So hill has many, many implications in over here. So I'm having to be careful what I say and to whom I say.
Oh, I know. And just as a sort of a riff on what you just, as far as hills are concerned, around here, people who live around here, you know, we call them hills. These are the hills. We are hillbillies.
Mm-hmm.
People who've never seen them, they call them mountains, and because they are. But then my father always got great joy, and a bit, you know, we never traveled down the road. U.S. 43, it is, going south out of the shoals into Franklin County. You go up this rise.
Mm-hmm.
You may have even traveled it once upon a time.
Mm-hmm.
There's this little rise. It's nothing in particular. And my father and mother would always sit there and just laugh cackle like they were about to lay eggs every time they went up what was proudly referred to in the region as Russellville Mountain.
Yeah.
Actually, Russellville Mountain. Russellville Mountain.
Russellville. Yeah. It's like going down over the mountain to Merville.
Yeah. Right. And you know, Margaret, you see a mountain anywhere around here? No, Kenneth, I don't see no mountain.
Well, it's
mountain.
Yeah, when you told me, well, if you go up on Outlook, what is it?
Lookout Mountain.
Lookout Mountain. You can see five states. Well, God, I just come through all five of them states. What do I want to go back to up the hill and look at them again?
See Ruby Falls.
Huh?
See Ruby Falls. See seven states. It's.
Yeah, well.
I think the furthest out I ever got and saw a barn with that painted on it was Oklahoma.
Yeah. Probably, I think, maybe, they're ever damn where. And, like, I'm really going to go to Ruby Falls and go down in a cave on the New Madrid Fault Zone. But, you know, like, I'm going to go down and hang out in caves on the Earthquake Fault? No, I don't think so. I got things to do, you know. I mean, I wouldn't mind. That'd be kind of a good place to go, but, I mean, you know, if you're going to gotta die, you may as well die in the cave with the falls, you know. and it's winter time here, big time. I don't know about climate change, but, I mean, it's definitely, I don't know the difference because I've never been here before in the winter time, but it's pretty, it's just part near airy out there, you know.
And, well, you know, as I was walking into the studio, because I don't have any open windows here, we don't want to invite trouble. I don't have any. I walked past the kitchen window and I looked at it and went, snowing again. How about that?
Yeah, it is. Definitely.
You know, and it doesn't make me stop and sit. I don't pass that window, Kate, and go, god dang liberal scientists with their knowledge and science and, there ain't no such thing as no global climate change. Yeah, if there was global climate change, we wouldn't be having snow in February in West Virginia.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it wouldn't be 23 wind chill factor here in the middle of the day. It's only February. Yeah, well, anyway, but it is definitely, I'm to understand that it is definitely winter because in my house, I live in the orchard house overlooking the apple orchard, and it was belonged to the original. Well, not the original owner, but he was adjacent neighbor. And when he retired and got ready to sell out, they got first dibs on the property. So they bought the house and the orchard and the little hill it's on. And, so I live in this house. Oh my God. It's so well built. I'm used to seeing pieces of crap thrown together, you know, down on the coast, and this place is, it's ran up good. I mean, oh my God, the woodwork is all, it's just a gorgeous house. And I live in the downstairs, it's built in a hill, so I live in the downstairs part of the house, and got my own little apartment, and the whole house is infested with ladybugs. They're wintering in the house.
Oh, wait, okay, now be careful.
I know. Now, let me just finish.
Okay.
I think they're pretty sacred because they're Tennessee state insect.
Not necessarily.
Well, okay.
There's ladybugs, and there's ladybugs.
Mm-hmm.
I'll warrant these ladybugs that you are talking about are orange.
Yeah.
Those are not the ladybugs that are the Tennessee state insect.
Okay.
A ladybug, as you and I understand a ladybug, is red. These are noxious little bastards that are not supposed to be here. They are Asian ladybugs.
Right, Asian beetles.
And they, not like a Japanese beetle that eats your grapevines or anything.
No.
These are Asian ladybugs, and they have proliferated across the United States. They are a nuisance. We lived in a house one time that had wood plank panel walls, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the ladybugs would, you couldn't get rid of them in the winter. And they got in everything. They got in your food. They got in your water. They got everywhere.
Mm-hmm. They're looking for a place to lay fertilized and unfertilized eggs. So when the larvae hatch, they can eat the unfertilized eggs. They have something to eat when they get born.
Well, I don't know. Is this their breeding season? I don't know. But I know when cold weather comes anymore, that's when you see them.
Yeah, we got little houses just full of them.
And that's not the way it is. And that's not the way it is with a traditional red ladybug.
Well, I'll just have to look and see which ones I got because they just...
So if they're orange, don't feel bad about cranking up the vacuum cleaner and just, you know, getting rid of them.
Well, they just kind of come in and die. You know, I mean, they hang out a bit and then die, and there's little things all over the floor by the one wall, and you know, whatever. I don't know. I just thought they were kind of special.
No, the red ones are. The red ones really are special. These not so special.
Well, I'll have to check that out and see which ones are invaders and what. I know that they are not. They eat the right things. They are the natural insecticides in the garden and all that stuff. So they, and they don't bite and all blah blah. So they, you know, I could share my little apartment downstairs with ladybugs. I'm not picky. I'm easy to get along with. So I think that's about it. I wanted to just check in because I get all excited. I pick up a book, and there's a book that Biggers had done a review on, or he done a forward in it or something. And then I pick up another book, and there's somebody, UMW, and I recognize the name of the organizer from Harlan County, I'll have to. I'll have to keep notes and find out more about these people instead of, so I don't have to read the whole damn book. You know, call you and say, what do you know about this guy? What was that? You know, the Hazard County disaster, the big old massacre in Hazard County, Kentucky.
Oh,
he was the organizer of.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. I can't get the name.
Yeah, anyway. So I pick up all these books on union organizing and toxic waste and women's studies, and I guess I was really saddened, and in closing, I was really saddened. There's a 2004, probably a four publication, really thick book, and the title is, putting the energy back in civil rights, or putting the organizing back in civil rights movement, or putting the movement back in the civil rights organizations. And it's written for K through 12, and it's got all the history, and it's got the board of us that sits on this, the board of directors that sits on this organization is filled with old timers, and you know, and it's teaching the kids all about the history of the movement and how to, you know, how to organize and all. And I thought, this is where we lost it. I felt so sad. About an hour ago, I thought, I gotta quit. I can see now where we lost it, because the movement, you know, we were going and going and going. All of a sudden, here come Reagan, and it all fell apart. And I know, I suppose other people have different perspectives, but that's where it all fell apart for me, because we were on a roll, and it just got, we got rolled over the top of, and we just kind of sat down and went, oh, well, screw it, I'm tired anyway. And now here we are at Highlander. Still, we're just doing the same thing we did in the 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s, doing the same damn thing, you know. Poor health, no groceries, no money, toxic waste, no unions, and hardly any more music, not, you know, in a lot of people's lives. But, so, anyway, that's what we're doing here. Just bring on the songs. Pardon me, another one. So I got to go. I got to get home. It's way dark, and it's way cold, and the refreeze has started, and I've got a little piece of asphalt that goes up to my house, and I'm not even sure I can get up the hill to my home. So
that might be just a little too exciting.
Hmm?
That might be just a little too exciting.
Yeah, I can park at the bottom of the hill. I'm about 0.5 miles from the library, and about 0.75 miles from the main office building up here on the hill. And it's my hope that I'd be getting, by the time I get ready to go back to Arizona for the summer and then come back for the fall, I'm hoping that I will be able to walk to work. There's some hills that are just, so I think it's 0.5 mile to that library. It's going to feel like 2 or 3 miles. Maybe somebody come and pick me up and take me home, because there's just, it's nice walking, nice gravel road, and really a good way to work off all the, well, yeah, the energy and the rage. So anyway, I gotta go. I was gonna cut this short, but you know, you always get me in arguments, and I am.
Well, now quit that. I did not get you in an argument.
No, you didn't.
Michael from Ohio might, otherwise known as Kid A from the chat room.
He
sent along a note, and he says, and this goes back to that whole war versus not war thing.
Mm-hmm.
He says, it is a war. We are at war against the people of Afghanistan and Iraq. It is also an illegal occupation, but foremost, it is an illegal war. It's not like we're just over there with the safeties on, camping on someone else's lands, occupying our time and occupying their space. We are doing warfare. He says just because Congress hasn't done their job and declared it, I don't give an F. The wars will never end if we start using what sounds to most folks' ears to be a euphemistic, sterile, legalistic term, occupation. I don't want what Michael says in all caps, I don't want the ignorant Americans to ever forget we are making war. War. And he says, with all due respect to Kate.
Oh, thank you, Michael. Thank you. I, you know, like, all of that aside, I just want to quit sending our babies away to kill them and send them home in pieces and mangled and crazy. I just want that to stop, and that's all I'm going to say.
Well, I don't think that's a particularly misguided approach.
Just gets me, I just can't even hardly talk about it. I just, if there was somebody I could hurt to make them stop doing what they're doing to our babies, I would just hurt them in a heartbeat. Without even looking up. Just sing my way right to prison. Hell.
Oh, yeah, singing, yeah, maybe be bunk mates with, what's her name, Amy Bishop?
Well, I don't, you know.
Who, by the way, went to the shooting range the week before.
I know. I just read that story. Who knows what was.
But I love the fact that won't play in Alabama. Now listen, she may have gone in and shot up the biology department and killed 3 people and got 2 more people in critical condition who may die yet. But the fact that she went to the shooting range ain't got nothing to do with it. All kinds of law-abiding Americans go to the shooting range and empty 400 or 500 rounds into a paper target every week just for damn good fun. You know, because it's this kind of thing that puts the gun freaks really sort of at odds with themselves, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But this is not the behavior of a well woman. And so I have to, I have to see.
No, it don't matter. It don't matter if she's crazier than 4 o'clock. They're gonna give her the horizontal crucifixion.
Well, I'm just saying, you know, I don't know what was going through her mind. I don't know what she's been through. I'm not in her shoes, so I don't have any idea. But well.
Oh, I don't either. I agree. I agree with you wholeheartedly there.
Well, healthy, happy people don't draw down on a room full of colleagues and shoot them in the head.
But before you do go, I have to give you somewhere, if you can, to be tomorrow night. What do you got on the plate tomorrow night?
Just swatting ladybugs.
Okay, well, you might want to make it over the hill to Knoxville.
Why?
Because they are having an anti-mountaintop removal panel from 5 to 7:30 tomorrow evening.
Oh.
In fact, I would recommend this to anybody on our side because, among other things, you know, the coal industry is nothing but a bunch of big babies, Kate.
What's the venue?
The venue is the Toyota Auditorium.
Oh.
Of the Howard Baker Center.
Okay.
They're having a panel. It's an educational event about mountaintop removal at the University of Tennessee. And the coal industry, by God, we want on that panel. We deserve to be on that panel. You got to have us on that panel. And bless their little hearts, they said no thank you to the coal industry.
I was going to say, you're sending me into a room with Don Blankenship? What an ass you are. Okay, never mind.
Well, that's the whole point. The coal industry's all... They're all hurt and whining and crying because mm-hmm. their side's not being told about how they need them jobs.
Mm-hmm.
But we need warm bodies in the room.
You're sending me to UT at 5:30 in the afternoon in Knoxville?
Five.
Huh?
Five. I'd say get there at 4 so you can mingle and meet some real good people. I'm imagining, although I can't say for sure,
Judy.
I'm imagining, none of the CRMW staff will be there. It's just too far to travel in this kind of weather. But I'll bet you my buddy Ann League will be there.
Okay.
And, Ann is with, Save Our Cumberland Mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And she's just another one of those human dynamos of movement. And just a real joy to be around. And that woman knows from barbecue. If you can talk some Q.
Well, if the Russell Gap Road up to this place is pretty treacherous, even if it's just barely wet, after a refreeze, and so if we have any kind of weather, what I would do is send the woman, the librarian person, she works with mining and unions and stuff, and I will send Susan, I'll let Susan know about this, and she's already in, she lives in Knoxville, and so she'll already be on her way home, and so I will send her if I can't go.
Do please get this word out.
I will.
5 o'clock, Toyota Auditorium of the Howard Baker Center, University of Tennessee campus,
mm-hmm.
And it's like 5 to 6:30 or so.
Mm-hmm.
And the wonderful thing is you will be in the company of some magnificent human beings.
Oh, yeah.
I know that United Mountain Defense that did such heroic work after the ash dam spill at Kingston, they've been a big player in organizing this. I personally would love to be there.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can find anybody and they don't know that it's happening, say go be there. They need your support.
Okay. Who's the organization that's putting it on again?
Well, the information I'm getting is it's coming from inside. It's some group of, I believe, students and so forth at the University of Tennessee. But United Mountain Defense has played a big part in trying to organize.
Okay, if we have any weather and it looks like my roads are going to be not what I want to be out on in my little pickup that doesn't have very good traction when it's empty, you know.
Right.
I don't want to be down the mountain. But Susan will already be in town and I will tell her about it. So we'll try to get some representation there. That's very very cool. Thank you. Thanks for the invite. That's nice.
And it's up on the UT website because it's an official function of the university, and it is sponsored by the Sociology Graduate Student Association, the Center for the Study of Social Justice, and the Department of Sociology.
Okay.
So there's your primary organizers. And then organizations like United Mountain Defense have been trying to get the word out. But they need all the folks in that room that they can get.
Yeah, okay.
Because, you never know when the coal thugs are going to show up and start crying and screaming and carrying on. Because that's how they behave.
Shooting people in the head. Every time I think of that, guy in the YouTube that I couldn't view because my YouTube thing doesn't work, but I just saw enough 4-second clips of him that, I just want to bring it on, my boy. I want a piece of you. God.
you with your white supremacist tribal tattoos.
Yeah, really. I mean, who fella? Get out of here. Go away. I'm just looking to get a piece of somebody, and I maybe need to just calm my ass down, huh?
Yeah, and I love the way that they're describing this, Kate. They say, at the conference, a diverse panel of scholars, activists, and community members will discuss the various problems associated with mountaintop removal in the Appalachian region. In addition to exploring the inequities these communities face, the speakers will also highlight community efforts to promote solutions and alternatives to mountaintop removal. And, where in that panel is there room for some propagandistic coal thug saying, blowing the mountains up is good for our economy?
It's my job.
Yeah. My old lady won't be able to get her new tubes, her new bulbs for her tanning bed for next year unless I blow up that mountain over there. And, dadgum, if I want to listen to her squall at me over being striped orange.
You and the tanning bed, I just don't even want to know the genesis of that.
It's the truth.
Okay.
These mountaintop remover wives all have tanning beds.
Oh, okay.
Because we're supposed to use electricity God give us.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and you can spot them from a mile away because there's orange as the banner on this University of Tennessee, the website.
Go big orange. I met somebody who, one of the big shots in Tennessee, Ram guy. He and his wife are friends with Coach Pat. And I said, ooh, can I touch your hand? and they kicked some butt over Mississippi last week. Ooh, honey, what a good game that was. I only have a little bitty, bitty, bitty transistor radio, the one that, in The Deer Hunter, remember that movie?
Oh, yes, very much.
The one that she was laying in bed, turning the channels back and forth, that little bitty radio she was...
Yeah.
Okay, well, I plug my one little earphone in and just curl up in my sleeping bag in my little ladybug cool house, my little apartment, and I can thumb through and finally pick up... Oh, there it is. And I can listen to so the game was even kick ass on the little bitty radio, let alone.
You know what? Often as not, if you've got a good commentator, it's better on the radio. Mm-hmm. But then again, I'm a radio geek, so.
I was laying there all covered up, huddled out in my sleeping bag, holding my breath. Damn, she went in for those last, oh my God, that shot was beautiful. Anyway, we're dancing to architecture, is that what you say?
Dancing about architecture, yes.
Yeah, all right. So, hey, y'all, I'm out of here, and I got to get home. It's just so cold.
I'm going to feel terrible if you hit a slickety.
No, it's not. It's only like 25 feet of asphalt going into my little driveway. It's not no big deal.
No, there's no 1,300-foot drop-off on one side or anything, is there?
It ain't that kind of hill. This is East Tennessee. those hills, I can't sit in my driveway and look at the... And some mornings I can see the smoke. I can see the tops of the Smokies, and I can't... It's so beautiful, and they're covered with snow, and I can't tell if they're... Oh, my God, are they really that high, or is that a mirage, huh? I don't know. I'm used to mountains, and I didn't know they were that high here. Ooh, they're pretty, but you can only see them, like, one day out of five.
Wait till spring when the red buds bloom.
I'm gonna really try to be here as long as I can to see these trees, which...
And you know what? You're going to be long. You're going to be there long enough to have ramps.
Oh, yeah, I know.
Don't sound so dadgum.
I'm resigned
to it. Get excited. That spring tonic. When they're bringing out the ramps, you know that spring has come.
I know, and then I'll call you and rub it in. You still have some ramp vinegar, don't you?
I do,
yeah. I mean, I thought so. So,
ramp wine.
Ramp wine, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're...
Love to pour a glass of that for Donald Trump at his meeting of the Trump U.S. National Golf Club Society?
In crystal stemware. I want to be here for the trees to bud out and then probably go back to Arizona for a little bit and show some interest and visit around and, you know, do that thing and then come back in time for the apples because, that's like in September. And so... There's work over here for me for a long, long damn time. So, just got to get home. I hate it when...
Go home.
An hour-long call is just like...
No, it's 45 minutes, and it's more like 40, and I understand. Go home.
Without the commercials, it was only... With the commercials, it was only 40, right? Okay. That's why I only do this once a week. I only do one show a night. You all pick
two drink minimum. I wait all night for calls like these.
Yeah, thank you. Bye.
Later. Let's see. She's been from out in the Great Northwest. She has been from the high Rocky Mountains, from the low down Arizona desert, from the devastated Gulf Coast, and now. From the mountains of East Tennessee, that, by God, is our buddy Kate. So we will take a break now. It's coming up on about 3 minutes before 7 o'clock here in the Eastern time zone. You are more than welcome to participate in the program. Join in. Your thoughts are always welcome. We're just free-forming, I guess. We will take a little break, come back. It's Tuesday, hot diggity. That means we've got Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen and the Green News Report on the way. You are listening to America's listener-supported liberal voice. You are listening to the Horn.
You know, he armed Iraq. I wondered about that, too. You know, during the Persian Gulf War, those intelligence reports would come out.
Iraq, incredible weapons, incredible weapons.
How do you know that?
Well,
we looked at the receipt.
But as soon as that check clears, we're going in. What time's the bank open? 8? We're going in at 9.
I'm so sick of arming the world and then sending troops over to destroy the fucking arms. You know what I mean? We keep arming these little countries, then we go and blow the shit out of them. We're like the bullies of the world, you know? We're like Jack Palance in the movie Shane, throwing the pistol at the sheep herder's feet.
Pick it up.
I don't want to pick it up, mister. You'll shoot me. Mister, I don't want no trouble, huh? I just came downtown here to get some Hard Rock candy for my kids, some gingham for my wife. I don't even know what gingham is, but she goes through about 10 rolls a week of that stuff. I ain't looking for no trouble, mister.
You all saw him. He had a gun.
I shot the sheriff, but I didn't shoot the deputy. Oh, no, oh. I shot the sheriff. Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's Tuesday, February 16th, 2010.
I love working for the people of Indiana, but I do not love Congress.
Bye-bye, Evan Bye. Super trains for China, not so much for the U.S. Freeways cause heart attacks, plus wacky weather for the Winter Olympics.
All of that and much more straight ahead. I'm Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Not to criticize the IOC, but on future Winter Olympic host city applications, you might want to add the question, does it snow there?
Great, now you tell us, Stephen. This is your Green News Report. Today's Green News Report is brought to you by Velvet Revolution's StopTheChamber.com campaign. It's time for we the people to fight back against the corporate cash laundering operation that is the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, especially following the recent Supreme Court ruling allowing unlimited corporate cash in American elections. Please sign on and donate to StopTheChamber.com. To help the citizens take on the unapologetic corporatists. Yes, it's your democracy. It's time you use it or lose it. Visit VR's StopTheChamber.com today. Okay, Desi Doyen, we're keeping an eye on the Olympics, where they're having trouble getting quite enough snow up there in Vancouver to run some of these events.
Well, actually, now the problem is too much snow. The weather is still erratic in Vancouver for the 2010 Winter Olympics. Today's downhill skiing events on Whistler Mountain were postponed due to lack of visibility, and tickets were canceled for some Cypress Mountain events because rain has made the viewing areas unstable and unsafe.
Rain in winter in Canada on the mountains. But, you know, that whole climate change, global warming thing, that's just a hoax. Pay no attention to that. All right, what do you have for us today?
Senator Evan Bayh, Democrat of Indiana, announced this week that he would not seek re-election to the Senate in November.
There's much too much partisanship and not enough progress.
Bayh is rated the most conservative Democrat in the Senate, helping the Republicans stall President Obama's legislative agenda, including comprehensive climate and clean energy legislation. Now, on the one hand, this frees up Bayh to vote for climate legislation without having to worry about his re-election prospects.
Yeah, but what about having to worry about his post-Congress prospects when he goes to work for these guys?
You mean don't let the revolving door hit you on the way out?
Yeah, really. I'd love to see him vote the right way for a change now that he's not beholden to these guys, but I suspect he's going to work for these very corporations he's been supporting for so many years in the Senate.
Other countries aren't waiting. They want those jobs. China wants those jobs. Germany wants those jobs. They are going after them hard, making the investments required.
That was President Obama in Tampa, Florida last month, announcing $8 billion in funding to upgrade the nation's rail system. But a recent report shows the U.S. investment pales in comparison to China, where the government is employing laid-off factory workers by building 42 new high-speed rail lines set to open by 2012. To compare, the U.S. has just one high-speed rail line scheduled to open in 2014. That's the one connecting Tampa to Orlando. A new comprehensive study from the Public Interest Research Group shows it's feasible to connect all major U.S. cities with high-speed rail by 2050. Check it out at our website, greennews.bradblog.com. And somewhat related, living near a train station could help some people avoid foreclosure. A new study examined three cities with high foreclosure rates and found that the chances of foreclosure are higher for neighborhoods dependent on cars. The reason why? Well, the price of a gallon of gas doubled between 2000 and 2008. Researchers say the record highs in 2008 hit homeowners in far-flung car-dependent communities especially hard, and they couldn't afford the additional financial pressure of the high cost of just getting to work. And if you live near a freeway, you may be at greater risk of heart disease. A new study from UC Berkeley and USC indicates that people who live within 100 meters of a freeway have double the risk of developing heart disease, known as atherosclerosis, the hardening of artery walls that leads to heart attacks and strokes. While the risks of air pollution from auto exhaust in relation to respiratory diseases is well established, this is the first time anyone's made a direct connection between pollution and hardening of the arteries.
So have you given us a clever case here? You talked about high-speed rails. You talked about the fact that if you live near a train station, you're going to save a lot of money, your life's going to be a lot happier, and if you live near a highway, you're going to be a lot less healthier. Just what are you trying to say, Desi Doyen?
Well, you know, 1.5 million people in Los Angeles County live within 300 meters of freeways. That's a lot of heart disease.
Time, ladies and gentlemen, for new rules.
The organic dairy industry is booming from high demand from consumers. So this week, the U.S. Department of Agriculture announced some new rules to ensure that organic dairies are actually organic and abide by regulations. Up to now, the regulations were, shall we say, loose with lots of room for interpretation. The new rules establish legal definitions and strict requirements for grazing in actual fields, on actual grass.
Nothing about the cows living next to train stations or highways?
No, nothing at all. Okay. While the Bush administration pretty much ignored the entire industry, last year the Obama administration suspended the organic certification of one of the nation's largest dairy producers for violations. And finally, an update on ClimateGate, the hacked and stolen emails of climate scientists at one of the world's premier climate research institutions. An ongoing forensic investigation into the hack shows the hackers were located somewhere on the east coast of North America and shows that they repeatedly accessed backup email servers over a six-week period, going through thousands of emails as far back as 1996, but only a tiny fraction of the emails were released, indicating the hackers sifted through to find only those that appeared to cause the most damage to the scientists' reputation.
Senator Inhofe, have any experience with hacking emails? I'm just saying. Read about that and much more at our website, greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right.
We do?
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
Oh, my little DJ soul just loves it when I come up with a bumper going into a break like that one. Thanks, John Fox, for the Bill Hicks clip. Bill Hicks, the patron philosopher, patron saint philosopher of the Head-On Radio Network. Pick up the gun. And you know what's amazing about that clip? Bill Hicks died in what, 1993, 1994? And it is as relevant today in 2010, maybe more so than it was when he uttered the words. Such is the mark of genius. But to butt that clip up against Bob Marley's "I Shot the Sheriff," whew, perfect! Wow, that was tasty. So yeah, okay. Pardon my self congratulations, but I love pulling off a good break like that. I really, really do. It's about 14 minutes past the hour. We are closing in on the halfway mark of tonight's Tuesday night edition of Head On. I am, of course, Bob. Just Bob. No Mr. Kincaid's here. No formality. We're just neighbors. Just neighbors chatting. Doing what people have done since time immemorial and using some pretty cool technology to pull it off in the long run. And seriously examining how we can expand the reach and the breadth and scope of that conversation. And I mentioned a little bit of it toward the end of the program last night, and I thank you very much for your emails about trying to move into video, and they were overwhelmingly positive. And we're going to try to do it. And shh, don't tell anybody. But here's my plan. Tuesday, the 23rd of this month, you know, like a week from tonight. Yeah, 16 plus 7 is 23. Yeah, that's Tuesday the 23rd. We're going to be in a beautiful Institute, West Virginia, not far from a massive tank of methyl isocyanate. You know, a big tank of Bhopal. They really ought to change the name of methyl isocyanate just to Bhopal. What you got over there? Big tank of Bhopal. And, of course, it's okay to keep it here because, you know, Bhopalese, Indians, hillbillies, you know, West Virginia State University, the historically predominantly black university of the state, great place to put a great big tank of Bhopal. You know, right on the verges of the banks of the Kanawha River, the great Kanawha River. We're going to be down there. We're going to be at West Virginia State University on campus, and we're going to be broadcasting a lecture presented by the Seneca II Group, a brilliant group of women who are dedicated to putting more information out there for more people. And Ray McGovern and Robert Perry are going to be there. Now, here is the trick. we're going to try to not only send the audio, but a picture, too. What do you think? Because it's not gonna, I'm not gonna be doing a show per se or doing a lot of talking or anything. So it means that I've got the requisite time to focus on the technical aspects of getting the getting the job done and hopefully getting it right. No guarantees. It's pretty much a lead pipe cinch. We'll have the audio to you, assuming that everything works. Everything works on our end. If the folks at West Virginia State get everything working, we're good to go and golden. So we'll have the audio for sure, and you can listen to that at the usual time and the usual place, and we'll also put it up as a podcast. But, forgive me, I'm excited at this. Admittedly, like I've said before, I don't get video. I'm a radio guy. I like to listen to stuff and let my brain fill in the blanks. But a lot of people learn by and love having an image to go with the noise. And toward that end, if we're going to grow and go forward, we're going to have to be a part of that. So I'm trying to doing a lot of brainstorming and skull sweat with Michael, otherwise known as Kid A, because he's miles ahead of me in comprehending what all of this means. But trying to figure out what it might take to make this happen. And if it does happen, it will be a milestone. And I can't think of anybody who can speak to issues that would more information more needed than what Robert Perry has to offer. I mean, this man was involved in breaking the Iran-Contra scandal wide open. And he has been there since then, desperately trying to get real journalism out to the people. So Benny, the image will be that of the people who are speaking, not of me. I'm still real kind of iffy about that. You know, the camera adds 952 pounds. To me, it'll probably just be an even metric ton. But we'll figure something out. You know, if we start doing the show here with video, Agnes said to me last night, you know, Bob, this is going to mean we're going to have to get the theatrical makeup back out. I said, honey, I don't think you can help. Oh, no. I'll have you done up. We'll get you lighted and everything. It'll be great. Not so sure. But if that's what it takes to grow this show and to grow this network and to grow the conversation that you and I and all of us, everybody behind the microphones and behind the scenes at the Horn, have labored so hard to build to this point, if video takes us to that next step, then that's a step that I don't feel like I can get in the way of taking. It's got to be taken. And so we're going to try to take that first step a week from tonight, next Tuesday, the 23rd of February, on the campus of West Virginia State University in Institute, West Virginia. I hope you'll be here for it. And I hope it's everything that I imagine that it probably will be. And by the way, just because I spend so much time gooning on the awful, rotten, mean, nasty things that happen in our world, let's try another little experiment. Let's see how good news plays. Because you'll recall that it was Friday night when I brought you the story of the really scary Islamville story run by Action News Team Channel 5, otherwise known as the dog in the ratings book. and how that led to a vicious spray paint attack on a mosque, a Somali mosque in Nashville, Tennessee. Well, now we have the upside of that story. Something that Nashvillians can, and Tennesseans can be proud of. And that is the fact that after the Al-Farouq Islamic Center in Nashville was vandalized with a bunch of anti-Muslim graffiti and a note that said, enemy is Islam, yeah, clearly a Michael Savage listener, or, I don't know, a Southern Baptist, you know, you get that stuff in church, too, down there. A group of people have come together in the neighborhood, non-Muslims, Christians, non-Christians, they've come together and worked toward cleaning up the hate-filled graffiti. They weren't asked to do this by the folks at the Al-Farouq Islamic Center. They did this of their own free will because their consciences told them it was the right thing to do. One person quoted in the story is a man named John Tai. He showed up to help clean up. He said, it made me sick to my stomach because I don't expect this in Nashville. Also included in the group were spiritual leaders from a number of various faiths. And the folks at the Al-Farouq Islamic Center then hosted an open house. And they did everything in their power to make it more accessible so that people wouldn't be, you know, as humans, otherwise known as hairless apes, relatively freshly, you know, low these 2 million years, down from the trees. We're suspicious. And the only way to eradicate suspicion is with openness and hospitality and a reminder of the warmth and collegiality that flows from our common humanity. And so that is what the folks at the Al-Farouq Islamic Center in Nashville did. They opened their arms, opened their hearts, and opened their doors. And 150 people made a personal pledge of support for local Muslims in the wake of last week's defacement of the Al-Farouq Islamic Center. God, when people come together in goodwill like that, that's when you can begin to see real seismic shifts in the consciousness. Now, you know me. I hold no brief whatsoever for organized religion. None. And I think I can present a pretty compelling case for the fact that religion through the centuries and through the millennia has been a net loss, not a net gain to humankind. Religions never do good. However often, practitioners of religions, motivated not by their faith but by their own consciences, do magnificent works of good. And so it is in Nashville, where conscience has won out. Where conscience has won out. Over hatred, fear, ignorance, and bigotry. And that is, oh, that's a very good thing. That is a very, very good thing. So, congratulations to those 150 or so people in Nashville who are getting it right. See, everybody's getting into the act now. This from our buddy Joe, the foxhole atheist. Hey, Bob, if the video idea works, you should get a bunch of friends over just to do a Rocky Horror Picture theme just because it would be funny. Moran Monday would be a good spot for it. All the... There's no end to what this can be. There's all sorts of stuff to be taken into account. But trust me, you don't want to see me done up as Dr. Frankenfurter. I'll be, I don't know, Eddie. Or my personal favorite character, Riff Raff. I'm a Riff Raff fan, big time. But yeah, that is, it's a very small studio, Joe. It really is. It's an itsy-bitsy studio. I don't think we've even got enough room in here to do the time warp. So, I mean, there's lighting to be thought of, because right now the lighting would just be horrible in here. Not quite. We are not ready for prime time. Trust me. Believe me when I say that. So, we will, take another little break. We're at the halfway mark. Why not? We're at the halfway mark of the program. Light them up. Where the heck are you guys? 877-443-2366. 877, the numeral 4, head on, or on your nickel, 304-658-3333. Either way is fine by me. Email rolls into Bob Kincaid, BobKincaid, @gmail.com. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn.
I sailed on the water, waters of my wind at my back, I cut like a knife. The stars I followed, they led me true till I changed direction, started following you. Now I'm shipwrecked, so far from home. I'm just shipwrecked on these shores of stone. I have gone hungry, crazy thirst. I have no one to blame, lest I blame myself first, 'cause I saw that horizon and I felt that chill. Still I thought that I could catch you, baby. Now I never will, 'cause I'm shipwrecked so far. I'm shipwrecked on these shores of stone.
Shores of stone.
And this is just a message in a Bible, baby. This is just a sad communication. These are just some things I want to tell you. Nowadays, this is the only way. 'Cause I'm shipwrecked.
My, oh my, ain't that nice? That is, for those of you who will surely ask, and trust me, I know, that's Kevin Welch. That is Kevin Welch from an album called Beneath My Wheels. It goes back to 1999, and it is absolutely magnificent, the whole thing. You know what I may have to do? I may have to, pull a little something-something out of there, another cut or two. That needs played more often. That's just brilliant. At any rate, welcome back to the halfway point of the program. Let's go to the phones. Or not. How do you like that? Well, I guess you've made my decision for me. A reminder, again, not knowing exactly how many people would be within reach of this, but your presence and your warm body would be very much appreciated at the Toyota Auditorium in the Howard Baker Center on the campus of the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, tomorrow evening, 5 p.m. Get there early to get a good seat. Get there about 4, maybe. For Voices of the Mountains, a mountaintop removal discussion. I would love to figure out a way, some way to be there. But I don't think they fly airplanes between Charleston, West Virginia, and Knoxville, Tennessee, anyway. So I would love to be there. I'd love to. You know me. I want to bring everything to you guys. But sometimes that's a little bit difficult to do. But if you can be there, if you're anywhere near, you know, an hour's drive, hour and a half's drive, 2 hour drive, 3 hour drive, get there. Stand up for mountain communities. Stand up for the human beings, the human rights of the people who live in these mountain communities and have to live with the sickening reminder of their own demise every day with every blast that goes off. Showing up is half the battle. It really is. And it would be nice to see a whole room full of people show up for this discussion. So if you can get there, be there. Hey, welcome to the program.
Welcome right back. This is Tobias.
Hey, Tobias, what's up?
Well, you were all alone on the phone and needed rescue.
Well, yeah.
Thought I'd call.
Very good. What's up? How was the chicken?
It was good. We had a pan-seared roasted ribeye and garlic mashed potatoes tonight.
Ooh, living good.
Well, they were on sale.
I know how that goes. I am an intrepid visitor to the manager's special meat case bargain bin, and sometimes there's some really yummies there.
Well, we're blessed to have an IGA, an Independent Grocers Association, which still has one of the few grocery chains that still have a butcher. And honest to God, behind the glass, you can watch them cut the meat. You know, not somebody in, not a box boy in a white frock. You know, who, I mean.
Right. And truly, that is a lost art.
Yes.
What is it? Is that a charcuterie in France? Or I think that is, because it's not a boulangerie. Oh, well, there I go showing off. Sorry.
Well, I grew up on a cattle ranch. Like I said, the sheer number of people now who think that a porterhouse steak now, what Kroger and everywhere else will call a porterhouse, is actually a porterhouse. You know, when it isn't, it's just an oversized T-bone.
T-bone, right.
It's like, does it have a filet mignon hanging off the end of it? And if the answer is no, it ain't a porterhouse.
Yeah, because it's got to be a substantial hunk of filet.
Yes. And you can go back and look at the cut charts that were published, you know, pre-Great Depression, and you see those, and those were all changed. They changed the cuts of meat, and people were, oh, no, I don't really would have done that. Surely, you go back and look, because we always had meat, cut meat charts, you know, because we cut our own meat, and, you know, we were taught, you know, I mean, just like trying to teach my wife how to cut, you know, buy the whole tenderloin and cut your own steaks off of it. And know by holding it in your hand what a 8-ounce steak, a 9-ounce steak, a 5-ounce steak is, by without having to have a digital scale and say, Well, I have to weigh it. Well, you should be able to know it by hand weight. That's a lost thing.
Yeah, and keep your thumb off the scales.
Yeah. Or keep your thumb, too. People's knife skills, for the most part, people are not what they used to be.
Usual good fun. Had a lovely conversation with Kate, and what you probably heard was me trying to get folks who are anywhere within reaching distance to the big deal. I don't mean that negatively. I'm not being smart aleck. The mountaintop removal panel discussion in Knoxville tomorrow night.
Whenever you talk mountaintop removal, I always think about it because I have friends. I grew up in Whitley County, which you may or may not know. Right down on the Tennessee border. Their only claim to fame is that's where Corbin is, which is where KFC was born, where Kentucky Fried Chicken starts.
Ah, okay. Yeah, that's where the Colonel moved his girlfriend in with his wife and all of that stuff.
Oh, yeah, and he was nuttier than that.
Woo!
Because my mom's family, you know, is distantly interrelated to that family. And I remember going to his, 75th birthday bash in the 70s when I was a little bitty kid, and he was still alive, you know, obviously. He was frying chicken for everybody. He was the creepiest old goat you ever met in your life, you know. But
he did fry him some chicken.
Yes, and it was still good chicken then. Before it was all processed, because I worked for a company in the 80s that made food service equipment, and the reason they changed their name to KFC was because it was no longer fried.
Yeah, and it's also because it's no longer chicken.
Well, it's...
They're, you know, sort of genetically modified little, you know, beakless, wingless, well, not wingless,
yeah, but... you know, it was pre-cooked off-site and steamed on-site, and it was, you know, cause we made the steam units that put their chicken in. And,
no kidding.
Yeah, and that's why it tasted like a ball of snot, you know.
Well, you know, I remember that Harlan Sanders got into it when he sold the company off, and they introduced Extra Crispy.
Which, and if you know how they make Extra Crispy chicken, you'd never eat it again.
Well, and Harlan Sanders, the creepy old goat that he was, said it tastes like a damn fried dough ball on a stick.
Well, it was yesterday's chicken, which they used to throw away when he was involved. But they said, no, we'll just take it and, you know, heat the grease up and re-batter it and refry it. Ergo, Extra Crispy. So, it's like, okay. And that was John Y. Brown, which, you know, he was the governor of Kentucky for a while in the 70s, and that was his big thing. He's the one that bought KFC out from the old bird and took it globally. So, it was really his doing. But, anyway, when you talk mountaintop removal, you know, I grew up down there in Corbin with my best friend grew up. It was Williamsburg, which is right down, I mean, you're talking right on the Tennessee line.
Right.
And Gatliff Coal, which you may or may not know anything about, Gatliff Coal Company, I mean, they, which is a completely wholly owned subsidiary of, I believe, Teco, which is they were, for years, they were owned, I think that's Tampa Energy Cooperative or whatever, but Tampa, Florida owned them, and they were mining all that coal out and shipping it down there to burn in their coal-fired plants. Because all my friends, you know, worked for Gallo Coal. They were all coal miners. And I, honest to God, whenever I'd go stay all night at their house, as one would do when you're a kid, whenever we went up to Gatliff, because that's where they live, the Gatliff part of, Gatliff community of Williamsburg, that you, once you crossed over the train tracks into Gatliff, there was a sign that said, and it was there for years, I remember seeing it as a child, you are now entering Gatliff. You are beyond the law.
Nice.
And the coal company put that up in like the 20s. And even the state troopers wouldn't go up there. It was like, well, they'd call, if there was a problem, I mean, a murder, domestic violence, shootings, whatever, they would call the coal company, and the coal company's into quote unquote, use your little quotey fingers, internal security would take care of it. And you'd see these guys, and they go,
oh, thugs.
Hmm?
Thugs.
And they drove around in these white vehicles, usually white Ford Broncos. And that was the running joke when the whole OJ thing happened. We're like, well, he must work for Gatliff. And we're like, you know where he's running to? He's running up the gatliff to bury that body. And throw that body down a coal mine. Because and that was the running joke, which of course is a crass joke, but we were kids.
Right, sure.
And it was, you know, if anybody can get him out of that, it'll be Gallus Cole, because they got more money than God. And you know, and that wouldn't be the first body buried up in a coal mine. And I mean, and people think that stuff, you know, they think they watch Dukes of Hazzard and go, that's funny, you know, a little corrupt fat man, you know, controlling an entire community and owning the police department. Ha ha ha, that's funny. Ha ha ha, I can take you to those places.
Indeed.
But it isn't, you know, it isn't humorous anecdotal fun that is wrapped up in an hour and everything always works out for the best in the end. It's where people get murdered.
Yeah, plainly put, yeah.
You know, there's a southern expression, which I don't know if it creeped over your way far. If you've probably heard it, there's, you know, some people need them some killing.
Oh, yeah, he needs a good killing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I heard that my entire life growing up. It's like, you know, well, you know, certain stuff just happens because, you know, he needed some killing.
You remind me of the closing line of a great short story by Flannery O'Connor. The name of the story is A Good Man is Hard to Find. And there's this just shrewish, batty old grandmother who gets the whole family in trouble and, you know, and on the verge of murder. And, because nobody's going to run out and read it. At the end, the psychopath, who is known as the Misfit, blows away Granny, and his final remark is, you know, she would have been a good woman if they would have been somebody there to kill her every day of her life. So, yeah, I know what you're talking about.
But there's, you know, I meet people, and it started when I was in college, you know, because you went away to a liberal arts college, and you meet people that go, and you tell them about your upbringing, and they're like, well, I didn't realize there were places like that. It's like, you know, that sounds like something out of the last century. It's like, guy, I can take you places where people don't have running water right now. You know, you ask them who the president is, and they have no earthly clue because they don't have a television, they don't have a radio.
Oh yeah, I left I left Alabama for college when I was 18 years old, and was happy to have the Shoals in my rearview mirror. Because I was young and stupid. But it's not like I went to Harvard or anything. I wound up at a little college out in Missouri. You know, come on, Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
But I was going to school with kids from Chicago and kids from St. Louis and kids from Kansas City and, considered themselves more sophisticated than some redneck from LA. And I actually got queried as to whether or not we wore shoes. And I said, well, you see, they're on my feet. They're brand new. Got them just before I come here. Generally, we don't wear them in the summertime. We got a big old tree in the backyard, and our pastime shinnying up and down that tree. We was going to shinny up and down the new phone pole, but we got splinters, and they sat there and just swallowed it whole.
Really?
You know, come on, it's Missouri. But, yeah, people believe that, Tobias, because they want to believe that.
Well, I have a belief that is the foundations of the stones of our lives are made up of all of these places. You know, as much as we're all a tapestry of who we are is woven of these threads of the places that we're from and the people we encounter. And some of them are not the most savory of characters, and some of them are not the most eloquent of places and nice of situations, but without them, we wouldn't be who we are. If you remove them, if you go back and these people say, God, that's horrible, I wouldn't have wanted to endure that, when you tell them. Because, I mean, I'm a survivor of child molestation at the hands of a minister. And people say, well, how could you possibly enter the ministry? And I say, well, I judge the measuring stick for Christianity is Christ, not other Christians. Because if I judge Christianity by other Christians, shudder to think. And I have the same reaction you do when you were saying earlier about good can be done by practitioners of religions, but typically not in the name of those religions, you know.
Yeah, well, and in fact, I have a study, was sent word of a study that came out not too long back. Let me see if I can pull it up here. Lo and behold, and I guess it comes as a surprise to some. It comes as no surprise to me. Yeah, there it is. Our buddy Larry down in Florida sent this along. The old canard that people who do not believe in a supreme being are untrustworthy, without morals, and unethical has received yet another rebuke. That's a good Bible word, rebuke. According to a new study published in the journal Trends in Cognitive Sciences, that's why I can just imagine me reading that. That's one of those where I'd have to read two-line paragraphs six or seven times just to understand them. According to a new study published in the journal Trends in Cognitive Sciences, atheists are, quote, just as ethical as churchgoers, and religion is only one way through which people can manifest a moral code. Dr. Mark Hauser of Harvard University reported that his research team was investigating the foundations of moral behavior and religion. The research suggests that intuitive judgments of right and wrong seem to operate independently of explicit religious commitments.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, shall we remind ourselves and everyone else that Adolf Hitler was a baptized and in good standing member of the Roman Catholic Church?
Never excommunicated.
Nope.
And I always pointed that out when I was a Catholic. Catholic for 10 years, I brought that up. I was like, the fact that he was a Catholic in good standing.
And still is.
You know, my baptismal priest at the time said, well, the church, and he didn't cop to it. He said the church made some wretched and just despicable decisions, and they should be held accountable to them. I said, well, at least you're not hiding behind us, because the fact that he was a Catholic in good standing, and still is, they've never rectified it by saying, you know.
And you know what? John the 23rd, who was responsible for Vatican II, which I'm sure you're aware of,
yep,
got himself in deep trouble with the church hierarchy before he was, voted, elected, selected, whatever. Smoke went up a chimney somewhere. Pope. And he got himself in trouble because he was castigating the church for not excommunicating Adolf Hitler. And, of course, he got dead relatively quickly after he got to be Pope.
Yeah. He needed him some killing.
See?
And, well, it becomes this, what the average American, and the average person for that matter, but certainly the average American, can't tell you the difference between morals and ethics. That's a ball of wax they just lump all together. What's the same thing? No, it's not. You can have ethics, because they don't teach that. They don't teach you ethics in school. You know, the only time the average person ever even hears the word is when it's in a blurb on the news, when they hear it used to be mixed up in terms like business ethics, which is a contradiction in terms like military intelligence.
Indeed.
Because, you know, should they be teaching these things? Absolutely. It's just like these Baptist so-called friends of mine that I've grown up with who'll say, well, yeah, these people who've got more house than they can afford, and that's what tanked the economy. And I'm like, yeah, no. Or, you know, people defaulting on their credit cards. And I'm like, yeah, you guys think that's a sin, but what's the bigger sin? Somebody defaulting on a credit card because they can't pay it because they made the decision to buy food.
Well, do you remember the story along around about Christmas time of the priest in England? I forget if he was Catholic or Catholic light. Anglican.
Mm-hmm.
But he said, he told people, go into these stores, shoplift, take their stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And my God, shocked gasps of absolute, he means it metaphorically. No, I mean, go in and take their stuff.
Right. Because that's the true thing. It isn't race that divides everybody in this country, even though there are racial issues. I'm not stupid. It's class. But race plays a part into class in this country. And the one thing that you're never allowed to talk about, Martin Luther King was allowed to protest, do all these wonderful things, but the moment he started talking about the last 6 months of his life, you know what? The disparities between rich and poor, he got a bullet in the head. The moment you pull the curtain back and say, guess what? It isn't divisions of black guy versus white guy versus brown guy coming to take black guy's job. Everybody be afraid. Is guess what? We all have a lot in common here. There's a strata of the people on top. Who was it? Who said, you know what? The rich are different than us.
That's the conversation between Fitzgerald and Hemingway.
Right. And the moment people get that through their head, you know, there's the strata. The rich are different. They don't want to play by the same rules. And they've got everybody convinced that that's why we're one of the few countries that does not ever produce any kind of actual statistical chart of what the rich is. You ask people, what's rich in America? Well, it's over $100,000. It's over $250,000. It's over, everybody, it's floating scale. It's a moving target. And it's like, okay, $1 million, we could all agree that over $1 million should be considered wealthy, unless you make $1 million. And then they'll say, well, we got two kids in college, and, the yacht needs to be gold-plated again, and, and it's like, look, if you can't agree that $1 million of liquid worth, total assets minus total debt, isn't rich, then we're done. But they don't ever want you to talk about what the true class system is. Wealth is the demarcation of class in America. And the people on the bottom have been getting hammered because, like we said, the last 10 years there's been no job creation. And wages have been going down. There's been no job creation. Inflation's been going up. So guess what? Your pay's been going backwards. The first thing Obama did was cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. So guess what? You're not going to get a cost of living increase because you don't need one. Because guess what? There's no inflation. Really? I can do math.
Yeah, and, well, it's... I don't know how to look... Some of the things that Barack Obama has done, President Obama has done, have been really tone deaf, Tobias. Genuinely tone deaf.
He's tone deaf to his base, and that's the craziest thing I can't wrap my mind around.
You want another example of that? Strap in, Tobias.
Hit me.
Strap in. Yeah, hit me. put a little stank on it.
Put some pepper on this. Yeah.
Headline, Obama nuclear plant, president to announce loan guarantee for more than $8 billion.
Yep.
Hello?
My wife asked me when she was watching them, and she said, do you think that's a good idea? I said, no, that's the most expensive way to boil water there is on the planet.
More than $8 billion in new federal loan guarantees to build two nuclear reactors in Georgia could be the first step toward a nuclear renaissance in the United States. A renaissance? Really? Do we want to be using that word with nuclear? Isn't that so? Oh, God. We got to fight this fight again, Tobias?
And when the people that got him elected the first time do not show up in droves at the polls. When they have a recipe for success, it's like it was brought up last night on your program, and when they stay home, just like they did in Massachusetts, then...
This is only the beginning,
Have you been listening to Malloy?
Oh, yeah, every night.
He's calling for, let the Republicans have the whole ball of wax back, have a Democrat blowout. Just let them, And if this stuff keeps up, it will probably, it wouldn't surprise me if it had.
Bless her heart, Allison Fisher, who's an energy organizer at Public Citizen, said, this is a on the Obama nuclear plant thingy, said, this is a preemptive bailout where the government has already guaranteed to saddle taxpayers with any failure that the in nuclear industry might run into. And that's what it boils down to.
Has any nuclear power plant ever made any money?
Don't think so.
I mean, because you got to get past paying for it first before you get, you got to get out of the red to get into the black, right?
Yeah, and then there's that troublesome business of, you know, toxic waste.
Yeah, storage and sequestration of all the crap you produce.
Oh, there we go, sequestering again. You know, that's the neat thing about wind and solar. You don't have to sequester the waste from sunshine.
Yeah, exactly. A trillion BTUs.
And there's no wind waste.
No.
Now, you do have to pick up a little bat ceviche here and there, but, you know, that can be, you know, we can work on the bat technology. The bats and the birdies will be okay.
Trillion BTUs of sunlight coming at the Earth.
This makes me crazy. You know what I could do with 8 billion? No, before it sounds like I've gone all, you know, whoo, crazy. You know what we could do with $8 billion? Do you know that $8 billion, Tobias, would pay the salaries of every working mountain remover in the industry right now at the same wage level and put them to work really attempting to reclaim the mountains that they've ruined? For the rest of their work lives, Tobias, up to Social Security. And I'm talking about health care, and I'm talking about some sort of reasonable pension.
It's just like these.
And that would put people to work.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there are mountain removers out there who are laid off. And they weren't laid off because of something that, you know, tree huggers done. They're laid off because their bosses, like Don Blankenswine, are nothing but the most cruel and cynical profiteers. They don't give a damn about working people. That's why they're doing it in the first place, Tobias.
Yep.
Because mountaintop removal takes less workers than going underground. And the trade-off, of course, is that mountaintop removal then transfers onto the entire community, willing and unwilling, the risks, whereas a coal miner who goes underground takes the risk upon himself. We could... $8 billion. Oh, my God. $8 billion for two nuclear glow-in-the-dark boondoggles in Georgia. I read this and I yelled out loud. Agnes ran into the room. What's wrong, honey? And then she just looked at it and she, oh, that. Makes me nuts.
Well.
Makes me angry. You know, it's another, so Georgia's gonna get two nuclear power plants that they don't need. Meanwhile, Appalachia can go F itself some more. Right? Is that, have I got the message there? Was that the memo, or am I overreacting?
You're underreacting.
Okay, I feel better. Now, by the way, Juanita reminding me that TECO, Tampa Electric Company, that's her electric supplier that you mentioned a little bit ago.
You're welcome. If she ever wants to come to Kentucky, I can show her where they've decimated every county in the lower southeastern Kentucky to dig out all the coal that keeps her life on.
Yeah. And the thing is, Juanita, you know, Juanita is awake in the nightmare. She knows.
And that's just to show you how these gigantic mega exploiters tie the country together. You know, it's the reverse Robin Hood effect. It's robbed from... You know, one community. This country has no sense of itself toward the future.
By the way, on energy and economic policy, you're going to love this. Jay Rockefeller, my senator, has said that Obama is beginning to not be believable to him. Not on health care, but on the fact that Obama won't say, blow them up, boys! Get out the dynamite! Let me set the first charge! Let's blow up that there Coal River Mountain so they can't have no damn wind power! Yeah, thanks, Senator Rockefeller. He says it in his speeches, but he doesn't say it in his budget proposal. He doesn't say it in the actions of EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson, and he doesn't say it in the minds of my own people. Really, Senator Rockefeller? Your own people? Is that what we are now? We're not your constituents anymore? We're your people? How quaint. Oh, honey, we're serfs now. We're Senator Rockefeller's people. You know what? That one line would have been enough to ruin a politician some years back, Tobias. There hasn't been a negative comment about it.
When you tell these, you know, Republicans that our return rate of Congress and you know, congressmen and senators is, we have a 99% return rate. At the height of the Soviet Union, the Politburo was 98%.
Mm-hmm. That's the truth.
And you're like, well, they had less incumbency than we do. Yet, yeah, yeah. we're the freedom.
Yeah, we got us some freedom.
Yeah, and that's why I posted to the chat room last night when, you know, when we were talking about Huey Long. Long said, when fascism comes to America, it will call itself anti-fascism.
Yeah. And I just got this quote in from our buddy David in South Carolina. And Tobias, he said that part of Obama's talk on energy is that he's busy trying to please the Repiglicans. Check this quote out. That's why we need comprehensive energy and climate legislation, and why this legislation has drawn support from across the ideological spectrum. I raised this just last week with congressional Republican leaders. I believe there's real common ground here, and my administration will be working to build on areas of agreement so that we can pass a bipartisan energy and climate bill through the Senate.
Yeah.
Still bipartisan. Is that a verb, to bipartisan? Or can we just spell that with an F and a couple and a K on the end and point at us?
Maybe he'll wake up when the haze will wear off when it's Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. And you talk about, it'll be arm twisting and they'll get everything they'll give him nothing. And they're like, here's what you'll get, and you'll get exactly what we tell you you'll get. Because Mitch McConnell,
Chinless Mitch is the Senate Majority Leader. I can't wait. That's just going to be delightful because you know what? Chinless Mitch will do what we wish Harry Reid had done. He will tell the Democrats, in reverse direction.
Huh?
He will tell the Democrats to sit the hell down and shut the hell up. That they've got business to do, and they don't give a rat's rear end what a Democrat thinks. They're going to do what they want.
Yeah.
And Harry Reid, if he's still in the Senate at that point, will promptly piss himself. And, okay, I'll sit down. Don't call me a liberal, please, Mitch. Please don't call me a liberal again.
Exactly. And it'll be, this has been tied up far too long, and they'll ramrod some of this stuff through so fast it'll make everybody's head spin. It'll be like, this is the mandate. They sent us here to get the logjam cleared up. And by God, they'll go in there. Because the Republicans' mantra, if you remember, nothing else is this. It's measure it with calipers, mark it with chalk, and cut it with an axe.
Oh, that's good. It's also, true.
Exactly. You measure it with the finest device you can find to be the most exact, but then you cut it with the most inexact tool you can find because you don't care at that point.
Because you're doing destructive work in the first place.
Exactly. It's like, I worked as an engineer for almost 20 years in the appliance industry. The old running engineer gag was, Festimus sees the glass is half empty, and the optimist sees the glass is half full, and the engineer says the problem is you got too much glass.
Yeah, yeah. No, I understand what you're talking about. It's like sitting in the dentist chair with a little teeny tiny pinprick of a cavity, and seeing Dr. Maxwell Silverhammer come at you with a craftsman with a half inch wood bit. Yeah, it's kind of creepy. Tobias, wonderful conversation. I'm glad you rang in.
Keep on rolling.
We're going to try. And if you know anybody that might like to go down to Knoxville tomorrow night, tell them about it.
I sure will.
All right. Take it easy.
You too.
Bye now. Tobias calling from Kentucky, and onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Congratulations to Japan for being the biggest debt holder now to the United States.
Really? Bigger than China?
Yes. They've taken over once again. It's like the Olympics, Bob, for finance or something.
You know, I have not been following the Olympics. I have a very dim view of them, as a matter of fact. Not because none of the sports interest me. I find the idea of the Winter Olympics a lot more fun than the summer ones because, you know, I love all that slickety skatey stuff. You know, and that one particular sport where they cross country ski for a while and then shoot something, I think that's just cool. I haven't been following the Winter Olympics, but I have been following Japan a little bit because do you know what the organization Sea Shepherd is, David?
No.
Sea Shepherd, and you can go to seashepherd.org, is an organization that opposes Japanese whaling. Now, I have yet to figure out why it is that anybody needs to eat whale in the 21st century. And I get that the Japanese eat some, you know, pretty interesting stuff, you know, your deadly fugu fish and that kind of stuff. But a little minky whale sashimi, nah, I don't get it. But they go down, the Japanese factory ships go down into the Southern Ocean this time of year and start tormenting the whales. And Sea Shepherd goes down there with, it's got a boat by the name, a ship by the name of the Steve Irwin, another ship by the name of the Bob Barker. And they do everything they can to disrupt the whaling activities of these Japanese factory whaling ships. And I've seen some video of it, and it's amazing. And the name of the Japanese group that does this, it's the ICR. It's at icr.org.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a button that says, you know, translate this into English. And being as how I don't read Japanese, I kind of have to. But there's video and stuff there that loads, and you can watch what's been going on. And the ICR is the International... The Institute for Cetacean Research, because they say that this is research. This isn't really whaling, this is research. But we have to kill the whales to research them. And then when they're done researching them, of course, they eat them. But one of the best moments I saw, and it really would have fit in well yesterday with Moran Monday, is, footage of one of the Sea Shepherd vessels racing alongside the whaling vessel, and you know how they were whale huggers, I guess. You know what those whale huggers were doing to those poor little whalers?
What were they doing?
They were playing music at them.
Oh.
Yeah, isn't that terrible? But I love the title on the Japanese ICR site. It said, something like anti-whaling activists blast researchers with symphony music. So, you know, and you're like me, David, you see a link like that, you're going to click it, right?
Right.
Well, it turned out that what that was, it was footage of this Sea Shepherd vessel running parallel to the whaling vessel, and they were playing Richard Wagner's Ride of the Valkyries. And I guess the folks at ICR are completely just, you know, didn't get the joke. You know, because it's straight out of Apocalypse Now.
Right.
But I saw that and I just thought, You know, come on. Is there no way to convince? Is there nothing on this planet that is sacred and safe and apart from the human urge to exploit it, rape it, murder it, kill it, eat it? I guess not. And they were complaining, of course, about the false impressions of the false impressions about whales and whaling and whale research that are given by these environmental terrorists. Sheesh.
I actually saw a bit on the movie The Cove where they were talking about how in Taiji that two council workers had spoke up and told people that they were serving dolphin in the cafeteria. Dolphin was part of the Japanese cafeteria. And the amazing thing in the movie is because those two guys spoke up and said that, they stopped that actual practice of serving dolphin to children in Japan. It's a pretty, I don't know if you've actually had a minute to sit down and watch it, but I would sit down and watch it this weekend if I were you. It's top 10 documentaries I've seen.
Wow, okay, cool.
Yeah.
And for everybody else, title again, please?
The Cove.
The Cove, C-O-V-E?
Yeah, it's about the dolphin industry in Japan, in the caves of Taiji, and it goes into the politics of it. It goes into what you were talking about with the whaling, and it also goes into classifications and commissions and how the government works. And what's really interesting about it is it also ties into a childhood icon, which is Flipper.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the amazing thing about it is it goes into it's a really surreal documentary because it's tied to your childhood, even if you didn't watch Flipper when you were growing up and you watched on the reruns on TBS like all of us did. And you see the guy who was training the dolphins, and then you see the guy who is now, his name is Mike, he's fighting the dolphins. He's fighting against the practice of bringing dolphins to America. And it's a really interesting thing, because then you talk about it. I had no idea about this, Bob, but apparently, you know all the aquariums?
Yeah.
Around the world, the dolphin aquariums? This is going to make a lot of people sick, but it's true. The Japanese are only interested in the dolphins that look like Flipper. And you can guess what happens to the rest of them. So that image that's seared in our heads, people. That image that's seared in our heads that this guy had helped promote, and he said he got a Corvette, he had nice houses. He had done the whole, and it worked against him. It was his own living nightmare. And then he became the biggest activist for dolphins there is. But the insanity is they really do kill and just chuck dolphins that don't have the slightest resemblance to Flipper, because all these stupid ass aquariums demand dolphins that look like Flipper. So and there's also a great documentary. I don't know, you may have to rent the DVD, because there's a great, great documentary they put on about mercury in the ocean and the fish and the latest status updates and stuff like that. And it's a really interesting documentary as well. It's about 20 or 30 minutes. So I would definitely check out The Cove. I mean, like I said, it's beautifully shot. It's really sad, but at the same time, you know, and the reason why I bring it up, because the fact that those two people, no one else is going to speak out against the practice of dolphin meat in the cafeteria. If those two council workers didn't speak up, those children would still be eating that mercury-tainted dolphin, completely toxic. So those two guys were heroes. So you get a little bit of melancholy hope in there somewhere.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, whether it's the whale, and to sort of bring it around to where you started, David, it's another, you know, we can't say anything about the 9-year-old girls chained to tables in China because they hold our debt. And we can't say anything to the Japanese about the fact that, you know, I realize culture is one thing. Well, culture is everything. But there are things that do have to be sacrificed, like whale sashimi. It's got to go. Just can't do it anymore. Because if you keep doing it, you're going to stop it. Well, it's like mountaintop removal. If we just let them keep doing it, well, eventually they'll stop on their own because there won't be any more damn mountains and there won't be any more damn coal and there won't be any more damn whales.
This is true. And you know.
And you know, I draw a big, big, broad line between Japanese factory whaling vessels and allowing the traditional Inuit up somewhere in the now melted polar north to go and take a whale once a year. You know, there's a relationship, frankly. And there are still cultural traditions that value that whale and what it does for that culture, that tribe, those peoples.
You know, the trainer of the dolphin in the movie had a epiphany, a moment, which is what made him turn it all around. And it was really interesting. It was the fact that one of the dolphins that was one of the many dolphins that were stand-ins for Flipper, or actually there was 12 dolphins that were Flipper. Anyways, one of the last ones in the last series actually committed suicide in Mike's arms. And he said the reason why the dolphin committed suicide, see, you don't hear about this stuff in the United States, with good reason. This guy is banned from everything. But he said one of the reasons it committed suicide, because it was in captivity, it knew it was never going to be free, it knew it could never go in the ocean, and he was holding it in his arms. It went under the water, and it just refused to breathe.
And refused to come back up and get air, in other words.
No. And Mike said that moment did change him for life. And in the movie, which is why I say it's an astounding, phenomenal film, is because in that movie, you see the struggles and the pain that Mike's gone through. I mean, dear God, he's actually had one, he had one of his assistants actually choked with a leather belt on the beach. Because they were this involved in the saving the dolphin industry, and like I said, it's a really interesting documentary. I couldn't recommend it high enough, and I would definitely put it on your list for this week, Bob. If anyone's listening, I would definitely watch it this week. It's an important film, that's for sure.
Wow.
And before I go, I just wanted to say one thing. I know this may cause some controversy and a bit of disagreement, but I believe I'm with Mike Malloy on this one, especially after watching that Dick Cheney interview, Bob.
Yeah, that was pretty bone chilling, wasn't it?
Anyone who doesn't go after Dick Cheney at this point, I don't want to be on your team. I don't want to be on your team. I don't. I'm not going to be on your team. If you don't go after him right now, to me, Bob, it's black and white. And anyone who doesn't go after it, they're going to pay. They're seriously going to pay. In karma, or whatever you want to call it. But when I saw that, I think I saw two parts of the interview. When I saw that, I was like, there's no excuse now. He's come back. And he's actually saying, basically, this is what he's saying. What now, bitches? I like waterboarding. I like it. What are you going to do about it?
Eat it and smile.
That's right. And if they don't do anything about it.
And the important is the importance is who he is saying that to. That is directed not at some viewing audience. That is directed solely and exclusively, David, at Eric Holder and Barack Obama. What are you going to do? Indict me? Because I'll remind you that, Jay Bybee and John Yoo have already gotten a pass.
That's right. That's right, they have.
And they were the authors of that evil. Not inspiring.
I might have some type of semblance of change in the works if they actually reached out to Glenn Greenwald in any way. But I know that's never going to happen because Glenn Greenwald scares the hell out of most Democrats. That's why they don't talk about it.
Yeah, what they for? Yeah, what for? Being honest?
Well, they do read him. Well, you know what? That's true. For being honest, and also for following the letter to the law. When you follow the letter to the law, that makes a lot of people scared.
Probably all too true.
But anyways, before I go, the movie is The Cove. Go watch it. Actually, I would recommend it on DVD because you get the documentary on Mercury Rising and the extras are cool. But when you see that movie, your eyes will be opened to the world in which we live in, where it concerns the dolphin industry, what people are afraid to tell you, what even the most precious conservation societies around America don't want to talk about because they're so afraid of what's happening in Taiji and what's happening in Japan. And God bless those people for making that film. That's all I got to say. It's out in the open, and everybody can do with it what they will. I hope a lot of people continue to have this conversation and discussion about it. And I hope Mike finds another partner before he passes. He's getting up in age, and he said something that was really relevant. He said, you know, today we're just looking for that one person to pass the torch to, and it's really, really, really difficult now because of the commitment this requires and the danger that this lifestyle is, and the fact that it's not so stable a lifestyle. And when you see it, you'll see what I mean by the fact of what he goes through just to get footage of these of this dolphin tragedy in Taiji, and the way they go about it, and the fact that he never stops. In some ways, it's directly parallel to what a lot of people are fighting for in Appalachia, what a lot of people are fighting for in all around the world, basically.
I think
it's that glimmer, that spark of
hope,
of freedom, yeah, and hope, yeah.
Yeah, you mean the real stuff.
Yeah, they want the real stuff now, I think, yeah. And they're desperately, I think that's the problem that a lot of people don't realize, is like exactly what Sai Khan was talking about, what was in this film, was the fact that there are so few torches. There are so few torches left on this earth, and there are so many people on this earth, and yet it's so hard to find someone to light that torch now. It's a lot different than it was in, and again, it goes into the film, what's happened with the conservation movements and a lot of the movements and why a lot of these fractures and stuff like that. And again, that's why it's an interesting view. You get to see what exactly happened decade after decade and the steps that broke up a lot of these organizations and why we're at the point we are today when it concerns the environment. It's an enlightening view. So once again, I'll plug it one more time. The Cove.
Good deal. Thanks, David.
No problem, Bob.
Take care.
Later.
Bye now. Interesting issue raised in the chat room. And I always value Lottie's take on these things. He says, wait a minute, Bob. It's wrong for the Japanese to do it, but it's okay for the Inuit? Aren't the Japanese and the Inuit the same people, just culturally removed by a land bridge? If whales are considered an intelligent organism with self-awareness, shouldn't it be wrong for both? I mean, like human sacrifice was a cultural thing too, and so is head hunting. I get that. I get that. And I guess the fact of the matter is, I'm more kindly disposed to a group of Inuit in a little boat out risking their lives, as opposed to a bunch of corporate wage slaves on a boat not risking their lives. And you know, you could, I don't know, do you say the same thing about deer? And I'm not directing this directly at Lottie, right now, and it's a fact, okay, this is a fact, here in West Virginia and throughout a lot of the South, if you did not reduce the deer herd, well, I can't grow a garden in my backyard because of the damn deer. They're rats with antlers. And, you know, the last garden I had, 123 tomato plants and 72 hot pepper plants, and every last one of them were eaten down to the ground. Now, the whales can't be compared with that by any stretch of the imagination. Yeah, I think, okay, if it'll stop the Japanese predation of an endangered population, whales in general, then yeah, the Inuit gotta quit too. But bear in mind, the Inuit don't take nearly the number that the Japanese do. It's the difference between eating for survival and and eating for fun. There is no argument that the Japanese are going to go on starvation without their annual ration of whale sashimi. I don't know if you can say the same thing about the Inuit. True, Lottie. The whale doesn't distinguish. And they're much more than an endangered species. They are a sentient life form. And I believe that wholeheartedly. And that's one of those moments when I understand the danger of using believe. But I think one could make that argument reasonably and rationally. Back to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, good evening.
Good evening.
Let's see. I was calling because I was just listening to the last caller. And that was a very interesting call. I was I heard a couple of interviews with the guy who was a part of that movie, The Cove. I still have to see it. I need to go ahead and see that. But I've heard a couple of interviews with him, and it is pretty fascinating because you were saying that they're sentient and that sort of thing. They do have whales and dolphins. And I think elephants, for that matter, have as much brain power as human beings do. And that's tells you a lot about just the whole idea of how we relate to them. And, you know, I understand the issue of, you know, having to eat them and saying, well, these are really intelligent. How can you justify Inuits and other people like that eating them? But the difference is that's not industrial. I mean, that's not, that's like you were saying, a tribe trying to feed itself to survive, a few dozen per year probably to feed a few hundred or a few thousand, depending on the tribe.
I don't think it's even, yeah, okay, yeah.
Yeah, and at that, you're in coal country, and is there, I don't know, but would you say there's a difference between stripping, actual industrial hundreds of tons per year of stripping of coal and that sort of thing, or I don't know if you would mine coal to feed a several hundred people to provide power.
No, you're. I think you are pointing out my hypocrisy and doing a very lovely job of it.
I wouldn't say it's hypocrisy.
No, I do. I do. I catch it. You know, when I'm being a hypocrite, I catch it, and I give myself hell for it. And I think my Inuit comment is probably ill taken, or ill made, I should say, because there's no such thing as a little bit of mountaintop removal. There's no such thing as only a few communities affected. And by the same token, the same thing with the whaling. Whaling, there were, you know, even in the days when whaling first started, it's not like, especially on an industrial scale, Haven, this is, when whaling first started, it's not like the oceans teemed with whales. But the fact of the matter is, we had best by God on the ground, on the land side of things, pay attention to what we're doing where we live, and it would behoove us to pay attention where they live, the wet world, which comprises more of this world than the dry side does, because things like overfishing may well be one of the puzzle pieces inside worldwide famine and all of the Malthusian stuff that follows from that.
But I think the difference is that overfishing really began with industrializing, because, I mean, they lived up there, and as far as the Japanese even, and the Inuit up in the far north, they've been up there for thousands of years, and it's only, in the past 100 years or so that this idea of the idea that there might not be any more whales to fish for, that's a very new idea.
Yeah, and I'm something else is being pointed out by Gail down in Australia. She says, as far as I know, the Inuit aren't whaling on an industrial scale, and they're not doing it in the Southern Ocean whale sanctuary, where all types of commercial whaling are supposedly banned. This is quite a serious political issue for us in Australia, because they kill whales in our territorial waters.
Oh.
And yeah, I think the distinction is there, but I do not know for a fact that whaling among the Inuit, and this deserves more research, and I'll probably get a lengthy explanation from somebody listening somewhere along the way. I don't think that the Inuit literally eat the whales to survive. It's not a survival issue. It's a tradition issue. And if it's a tradition issue, then, well, you know, they could very well be in a place where the tradition dies for want of whales to take. You know, it's crazy making. It really is. And the fact of the matter is, there's a loophole inside the worldwide agreement on a whaling moratorium that says that they can be taken for research. And once again, it's a case of corporatists taking that idea, research, and using it as a cover for pure commercialism and conspicuous consumption. Because again, there's not a single person in Japan who is going to go hungry if there's not whale meat brought home. And God knows they're not lighting their lamps with blubber, and we don't need ambergris for perfume anymore. So, you see what I'm saying?
Definitely, definitely. And that's the whole idea of industrializing anything. I mean, regardless of where you go as far as what the topic is, it seems like industrializing anything has become one of the really big problems with society in general.
And if you take that idea of industrialization and follow it to its end, the only reason the industrialization is taking place is to profitize some particular sector. if there was not a massive structure in place, for instance, to make number two field grade Roundup Ready, brought to you by Monsanto corn, profitable to grow, then, you know, Mexican farmers, subsistence farmers, wouldn't have quit planting other crops in order to plant that and sell it, and thereby driving up the cost of maize meal and maize flour for basic breads, you know, the tortillas.
But of course, the excuse for that is that they saved millions of people from starving.
Not with number two field grade corn, they didn't. Simply because you can't eat that stuff. The only thing that can eat that is a cow or, you know, something that you're trying to short-term fatten up, because that stuff even makes the cattle sick. That's why they have to be, in turn, loaded up with so much antibiotics and so much hormones and so forth, because it's a way to quickly fatten a cow as opposed to letting it grow in its natural cycle. You know, that's one of the reasons, back to the Japanese, that's one of the reasons that Kobe beef is so much better than the stuff that we raise, because they let the cow go through its natural growth cycle. And it's much more marbled and much more tasty. And you know, we get into these meat conversations, and I just feel waves of hypocrisy just washing over me, Haven.
Well, that's one way.
Because I love me some Kobe beef.
Okay. Hadn't tried that. I should try that.
Oh, it's like butter.
That's one way of industrializing that doesn't, you know, I guess sustainable, I guess you would say. You can have that, you know what I mean, you can have that quality, but at the same time, you know, not eat your arm off, I guess. In spite of you know what I mean?
Yeah.
In spite of yourself.
And I think there was some good Michael Pollan stuff over at alternet.org in the last day or so. It might be worth going and looking at. He doesn't write anything that I don't just get all over, because it makes so eminently much sense.
Right.
It's hard to avoid. So, but you know, it's not an intractable problem. Sometimes you just have to draw a line in the sand or the water and say, we ain't going to do this no more.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's in the service of profit. That's the problem. Industrializing music, industrializing energy, industrializing just all sorts of things. Doing this in the service of profit is really, that seems to me like that's what the bottom line is, and that's where so many of these problems come from. And as a matter of fact, you were talking to me, mentioned the nuclear issue. Now, one thing that I didn't know, because it was in the Project Censor. They had one of their top 10 censored stories was about the fact that right around literally up the road from where I am, in Wake County, there is the Sharon Harris nuclear power plant. There is no Yucca Mountain, but Sharon Harris apparently has turned into a de facto Yucca Mountain.
Oh dear God, they're dumping that crap there?
Sharon Harris is the home for two or three neighboring nuclear power plants. They send their stuff here by rail. And that's been happening for years, and we have apparently this gigantic pool, or I guess a few pools of spent fuel rod. And I did not know that. It's also on Counterpunch. Pools of Fire is the name of the article. And I hope that these people don't think, or my president, Mr. Obama, doesn't think that they're going to be sending more of this stuff to Sharon Harris.
Well, they're going to send it somewhere. You know, maybe they can send it. Maybe they can send the nuclear waste from that those two filthy nuclear reactors that you and me are going to pay for. Remember, we're going to pay for it, Haven. Maybe they can send that over to Perry County, Alabama, and dump that amongst the coal ash there. Because, you know, that's usually how it works out. You find somewhere that people are where there's no rich people to complain, and you tell them to eat it and smile and call it economic development, and we're going to bring you some jobs.
Well, see, that's the thing. I mean, where they are in Wake County, where this particular power plant is in Wake County, I mean, that's Raleigh. That is the capital of North Carolina. That's the edge of Research Triangle Park. That is, I mean, these, you know, Duke, North Carolina State, the whole, this is it's a surprise that they would be able to, I guess they did it basically under the radar, because there's a lot of, you know, pretty well educated and, you know, high earning people in Wake County.
And yet,
but if they don't pay attention, or, you know, or if you feel like you're gaining the benefit, you don't necessarily care, I suppose.
That's a tough analysis.
But anyway, nuclear power is safe. Anyway, I don't know.
Yeah, right. Clean, green nuclear power. Here we go.
Right.
It makes me nuts. Watching an absolutely unresponsive government, you know, if your EPA administrator Lisa Jackson and you really care about this kind of stuff, and Barack Obama announces $8 billion of loan guarantees for two nuclear boondoggles that may never generate so much as a watt, how if you're Lisa Jackson, do you not get on the phone and say, what, you don't want me here anymore? You're done with me? You want me to quit? Is that the message here? Because there is no room for nuclear power as it is currently constituted in our energy portfolio. Because someone will have to pay the price for it with their blood, Haven. Certainly seems that way to me. You know, these are plants that are going to be in Georgia. I can't imagine that Mike and Kathy are particularly thrilled at the notion of little Molly growing up in the shadow of some sort of nuclear holocaust waiting to happen. And I understand a lot of the frustration I've been hearing out of Malloy lately, simply because, you know, daggum, you know, nuclear, this is a battle we fought and won a long time ago. And daggum, if a Democratic president isn't the one who's trying to bring it back. I'd expect that out of a Bush. I'd expect that out of a Reagan. But not the guy who promised us hope and change.
Right. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm squawking or something. I apologize. It just gets all over me. And yet at the same time...
We have two Democratic senators here. Wait a minute. We have one. I'm sorry. We have one. And I am going to write her just basically very short, very straightforward little question, not an essay. Just ask her, what do they intend to do? Does North Carolina have anything to say about what they're going to do with this the waste from these two plants if and when they get off the ground?
And you know what else you might do before you write that letter? You know, do a little self-education and study the wind patterns. See where the airborne radiation will blow. I'm not, and I don't know what the answer to that is, but it's something I would want to know if I was going to be, you know, because not that far from Georgia, and we don't know where they're going to build them. And you know, for me on my end, Haven, there's not even a net gain, because it doesn't mean less mountains are going to be blown up.
Right.
It's not like this is going to be a replacement for. This is going to be in addition to.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, you know, a week from tonight, I'm going down to Institute, West Virginia, where they got a great big tank full of Bhopal.
A tank full of what?
Bhopal. Methyl isocyanate. Same stuff that wiped out Bhopal, India. There's a Bayer Ag Sciences plant in Institute, West Virginia, that used to be Roan Polanc, that used to be this, that used to be Union Carbide. You know, same guys who brought you Bhopal.
Oh.
And I get the creeps every time I go down there. I know people who are in the fight, to get that out of there. And there have been accidents and fires, and still, you know, our government, nah, not so much. My God, a man working at DuPont in Bell, West Virginia, not too awfully far from here, he was sprayed with phosgene gas just a couple of weeks ago. Poof. Goodbye. And, you know, no real cane raising from our state government here. They sent out the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection, which is as useless as teats on a boar hog. Well, everything appears to be okay by us. That's comforting. Haven, good hearing from you, my friend, and I hope we will talk soon.
Have a good one.
All right, bye now. Somebody, Haven, calling from North Carolina. This rolling in from Cindy in the Great Northwest. Spent fuel rods, where to put them? Up the politicians' and businessmen's asses. Ron in Raleigh pointing out, a good friend of mine was an engineer at Shear and Harris. There is, in fact, open pool spent rod storage on this site. These rods and rods from other southeastern Newt plants are a part of the Southern Compact. They were supposed to go to Yucca upon completion. But, you know, they're just sitting there with nowhere to go. Gail writing in to add, with regard to the whale issue, Australia also fears for the safety of our favorite whale, a white albino humpback, who has been named Migaloo, which means white fella. He's easier to spot than a regular whale and also quite people-friendly, which makes him more vulnerable. Queensland have declared him a special interest whale. And Gail adds, in the interest of balance, I should point out that U.S. Navy sonar causes whale beachings, brain hemorrhages, and hearing damage in whales and other creatures. And that's the absolute truth. We have ignored what is literally under our very noses. We've ignored I subscribe to that view that the Earth is an organism in and unto itself. And, you know, here for a few decades, I've gotten to be, you know, a speck on it, as we are all specks. And as semi awake in the nightmare specks, what is our only moral choice? Our only moral choice is to try to be the best speck that we can possibly be in regard to the rest of the specks on the planet. And we're all specks. There are people specks and whale specks and mushroom specks and turtle specks. Snake specks, lion specks, bacteria specks. We're all specks. And imagine the manifest ego involved for one speck to think that it is better than another speck. And then there are some really, really evil specks that think that they are not only better than the rest of the specks, but have the right to do evil to the rest of the specks, and do evil to the whole organism that is this little traveling roadshow through the universe. This little blue-green marble time machine. You know, we can't go backwards, but we can go forward. We're all engaged in time travel. No, this is not suddenly turned into the Art Bell or George Norrie. But to the extent that there's a concept of time, we're traveling forward through it. Hello? David in South Carolina notes, the waste, of course, is coming here to South Carolina. And I'll bet you I know where in South Carolina. You find me the county in South Carolina that has the highest unemployment, the highest concentration of brown-skinned or dark-skinned people, and a place somewhere out in the piney woods with a pit in the middle of it, and yeah, it's gonna go there. Because it's not going to go near the well-to-do white folks in Charleston. Oops. I think I did it again. You know, meanwhile, remember the Obama administration, the one that wants to give $8 billion of your money to build a disaster... twin disasters in Georgia. Well, they're liberals. Bill Rainey, who is president of the West Virginia Coal Association, said we got 132 million tons of coal reserves that are still in the ground because them liberals won't let us get it. About 1,300 employees could be subject to some kind of action if these permits are not issued. It's hanging up employment. It's hanging up production. It's hanging up revenues. Oh, it was third on your list, Bill, but baby, it's first in your heart with a bullet. It's hanging up revenues. We can't get answers from the federal government. The fact of the matter is those 1,300 employees aren't subject to some kind of action. What they are subject to is having their worlds ruined. And they're subject to having their worlds ruined not by environmentalists and not by the coal, not by the EPA. They're subject to having their worlds ruined because they were placed in a situation of utter economic desperation. In which they had no choice, no real world choice, but to do the evil business that is mountaintop removal. Poorly educated and absolutely joined at the hip to mountaintop removal. And there's Bill Rainey saying that they're subject to some kind of action. That means their asses will be canned by the company, not by environmentalists. They will be canned by the coal companies because all they are, is a tool. No different from a backhoe. Or a dozer. No, they are different from backhoes and dozers. Because the backhoes and the dozers and the big dump trucks are actually more valuable to a coal company than is a human being. And that's what miles past sickening. Miles. So I guess that pretty much brings us to the end of the program. Thanks to you, those of you who jumped in to try to help us reach our monthly goal in the last couple of days. It is sincerely appreciated. We still need help, considerably more help. But we keep, you know, we keep going. If you can help, the way to do it is over at headonradionetwork.com. There's a PayPal button there. And there's a snail mail address if you prefer not to use PayPal. And it is sincerely appreciated. Thanks to Peter Godbold, John Fox, our chief engineer, Ben Birch, the man who's responsible for all the streaming and podcasting that goes out, whiterosesociety.org. Thanks to our moderators in the chat room, Sue, Lottie. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thanks to our blogger, Texas Betsy. To our southern correspondent, Matt Osborne, osborneinc.com. Thanks to Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and coalriverwind.org. They never quit. They never give up. and they are the bravest, hardest working people I know. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.
And it is cussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Hey, good evening and welcome aboard. You know, sometimes the universe does not cooperate with you. In terms of the plans that one has made for an evening's programming. For instance, yesterday, being Monday, was Moran Monday. And we did have our fair share of Morans. But God, we got buried with them today. Holy mackerel. And you know, we did yesterday without even a passing glimmer of a nomination for the former Vice President of the United States. You know, I know that they think that, and maybe that's what this is. It's just a finger in Attorney General Eric Holder's eye. But maybe, just maybe, maybe what they're doing is, well, Dick Cheney said, well, I was a proud proponent of,
well, I was a proud proponent of waterboarding.
He said that. He admitted it in front of millions of people on the TV box on Sunday.
I was a big fan of waterboarding. We had the Office of Legal Counsel to prepare those memos to give us cover for what we were going to do.
He said it! He said it! And these are the same people who complain about the FBI Mirandizing the BVD bomber by giving him his Miranda rights. Right? You know, these right-wingers are so godforsaken stupid. Do they not realize that you can't get a conviction or use the stuff that's been said until you've Mirandized the guy? That you can't use it in court, with that not Mirandizing a fellow is enough to get his conviction overturned, and so therefore there are some technical things. Look, you know, it's just like the mass. You know, you got it. There are some things that have to be mumbled over the cup before you can take the drink. There are some Latin words or whatever that have to be mumbled over the cracker before you can eat it. It's procedural, I guess, is the word I'm looking for. But Dick Cheney, Richard B. Dick, big time Cheney, actually admitted to war crimes. He admitted violation of the federal law. Never mind that squishy international law or those inconvenient Nuremberg promulgations. Dick Cheney admitted to a violation of a federal felony that carries the death penalty. And what he's betting on is that nobody in the Obama administration has the guts to call him out.
Pick up the gun. Pick up the gun. Pick up the gun.
He's betting on it. And it's a safe bet that he may be right. Oy. But that was that was pretty stupid. That was pretty moronical. So there's that. The other thing, but and climate stupidity. Climate stupidity. Oh my God. This is a beautiful thing. Donald Trump. Donald Trump has declared that it's time to revoke Al Gore's Nobel Prize. Now, whatever it is that makes the multi-bankruptee, flim-flam man Donald Trump think that he is qualified to comment upon issues of climate and science when the man can't even do a halfway decent comb-over. Well, you know what I mean. Agnes just walked in behind me bringing me my steaming hot cup of tea and saw the photo of Donald Trump that goes with the story I'm looking at and said, oh, my God, Bob. And she did it, you know, where we've been married for almost 17 years, and we can not only read each other's minds, but we read lips as well. And she said that she mouthed to me the words, oh, my God, he looks like flock of seagulls. Yeah, he does. The Donald was called to give him give a speech. He was called to do some speechifying at the Trump National Golf Club in Westchester County, New York. You know, you have to say all of this with your teeth clenched. There were 500 members of the Trump National Golf Club in Westchester County, New York, and he said the following. With the coldest winter ever recorded, with snow setting record levels up and down the coast, the Nobel Committee should take the Nobel Prize back from Al Gore.
Gore wants us to clean up our factories and plants in order to protect us from global warming, when China and other countries couldn't care less. It would make us totally non-competitive in the manufacturing world, and China, Japan, and India are laughing at America's stupidity. No, Donald, we're laughing at yours. Really, we are. I hate to break your heart, but we are. It's because here we have another fool who doesn't understand that local weather does not equal global climate. And I saw the best line the other day. I forget who had it, but there is no planet B. Everybody, okay, so much for plan A. Let's go to plan B. There is no planet B. This is it. This ain't the dress rehearsal for when we get to the clean planet. I mean, after all, the NASA's budget's being rearranged, we're going to do more robotic exploration of the... And we may finally find that Captain Kirk Class M planet with the sexy green the sexy green woman on it. We may. Or we may find one that's nice and clean and has never been just and it'll be ours to ruin. But that ain't happening day after tomorrow. Climate does not equal weather. But don't tell Donald that, because the snow is messing with his hair. Maybe it's the hair care products. Maybe that's what seeped through the skin of his scalp, down through the bone, and through the sutures of the skull, and got into his gray matter, and it turned him into an idiotic denier. Oh, and by the way, that business about making us totally non-competitive in the manufacturing world, BS. Absolute BS. Because the fact of the matter is, we hardly make anything in the first place anymore. One. And two, for instance, an American steel mill can make steel twice as clean and